Senate will come to order. Senator Martin, did you have something for us this afternoon?
Mr. President, I do. May I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, today we have with us here on the floor the Main Street Program Community Managers. Mr. President, we are all very much aware the health of downtown is at the very heart of the quality of life within a community. These folks here with us today are on the front line of the efforts to revitalize the downtown of their communities. And Mr. President, I'd like to introduce the folks that are here with us today. And if they would stand as I call their name, then we can welcome them.
Go ahead, Senator Martin.
From Buffalo, Marie Verger and Vanessa Vogel. Douglas, Cindy Porter, if you remain standing, please. Dubois, June Bonacera. Evanston, Jane Law. Glenrock, Kathy Patzig. Green River, John Dahlgren. Kimmer, Mike Archibald. Laramie, Trey Sherwood. Pinedale, Kate Grimes. From Platte County, Bruce Himbuck. Rollins, Pam Thayer. Rock Springs, Lisa Mueller. Sheridan, Stacy Coe. And Bonnie Gregory. Torrington, Roger Huckfelt. And the Wyoming Main Street staff, Mary Randolph is the director, and Scott Wisniewski as the program specialist. Would the Senate please welcome these folks here today?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Senator Martin. And there are indeed a number of familiar faces in this crowd, and I welcome not only them, but I welcome all of you. I do have a resolution here from the 61st Legislature of the State of Wyoming recognizing and honoring the downtown revitalization volunteers. And if I could have Pam Thayer, is Pam here? Pam right here in front and center. Pam, this resolution is in recognition of a lot of things that you do, and certainly there are a lot of accolades. But let me say that this is this resolution is presented to Downtown Revitalization Program managers as an expression of the Wyoming Legislature's gratitude to the residents of these participating communities who have volunteered to improve our downtown areas. And again, I say thank you to not only you, but to all of you so for what you do. So thank you very much, and congratulations.
Thank you, President.
You're welcome to stay as long as you like, but the beat goes on here. So, reports from standing committees.
February the 17th, 2011. Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution 3, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Case, and Hines. No, Senator Emmerich and Person, Senator Hines, Chairman. February the 17th, 2011. Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 178, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin. No, Senator Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 17th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election and Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 224, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 17th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 242 in gross, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 17th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 140, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Senators Dockstetter and Escobel, no. Senators Burns and Driscoll, Senator Burns, Chairman. February the 17th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 121 in gross, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Dockstetter, and Escobel. No, Senator Burns and Driscoll, Senator Burns, Chairman. February the 17th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 243, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstetter, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman.
We are now ready for bills on third reading and final passage, and we return to Senate File 1, third reading budget bill, and we'll continue with the amendment process. With that, I think the next amendment for our consideration is third reading amendment number 8, and I would ask that the reading clerk read that in at this time.
Senate File 1, third reading amendment number 8, Capital Construction, Section 006.
Senator Nutting, Senator Escobel, would you like to address that, please?
Thank you, Mr. President. I move third reading amendment number 15 to amendment number 8, Senate File 1. And, Mr. President, this basically just calls for that prior to the completion, this has to do with this building that the state recently purchased, which is about a block west of here. And as you've all heard, there's some plans to construct a new state office building in that area. So this just addresses that concern of the neighborhood. And this calls for that prior to completion of the Level 2 design for the Safeway building site, the State Building Commission shall hold public hearings and receive public comment pursuant to various rules and regulations and statutes that the state has. This is basically the gist of this this amendment, and I would hope that you would see fit to vote aye in favor of this amendment.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Any further discussion or questions? Seeing none, this amendment is calling for a process, has essentially no monetary effect. I would ask all of those in favor of third reading amendment number 8 to say aye. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. This amendment has passed. Third reading amendment number 8 has passed the Senate. The next amendment for our consideration is third reading amendment number 9. I'd ask the reading clerk to read that amendment in at this time.
Senate File 1, third reading amendment number 9, Budget 57, Community College Commission.
Senator Nicholas, would you like to move and address the amendment, please?
I would, Mr. President. I move third reading amendment number 9 to Senate File 1. Ladies and gentlemen, this addresses the Sheridan facility. It's a technical correction. We had to decrease the $15 million to $7.5 million. So it implements the change, simply technical. I'd urge your support.
This is a technical amendment, as the sponsor has said. I would ask all those in favor of third reading amendment number 9. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Third reading amendment number 9 has passed the Senate. The next amendment for our consideration, third reading amendment number 21, I'd ask that be read in at this time.
Senate File 1, third reading amendment number 21. Budgets Affected, Section 57, Community College Commission.
Senator Nicholas, would you like to move and speak to the amendment, please?
Yeah, I did. What's what it's like? 21?
Third reading amendment 21.
Thank you. I put it in the back. Mr. President, I move third reading amendment number 21 to Senate file 1. This also is a technical correction to make clear that the Casper facility can utilize the $32 million. It's a technical correction. I urge your support.
Comment? Questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of third reading amendment number 21, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Third reading amendment number 21 has passed the Senate. Next amendment for our consideration, third reading amendment number 24. I'd ask that be read in at this time.
Senate file 1, third reading amendment number 24, section 48, Department of Health.
Senator Nicholas, would you also like to address this amendment?
I'd like to move third reading amendment number 24. Ladies and gentlemen, what this does is it takes the $25 million that was set aside in the auditor reserves that we talked about earlier and moves it back into the Department of Health budget so that we bring the budget up to the total amount that was requested by the governor. There will be no more auditor's reserve after this function. I urge your support.
I think this is a considerable monetary movement. I would ask that the roll call be conducted on this, so I'd ask the Chief Clerk to call roll on third reading amendment number 24.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Emmerich?
Aye.
Esquibel? Geis,
aye.
Hastert,
aye.
Hicks, Hines, Jennings,
aye.
Johnson,
aye.
Landon,
aye.
Martin,
aye.
Meyer,
no.
Nicholas,
aye.
Nutting,
aye.
Perkins,
no.
Peterson,
no.
Ross,
aye.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
aye.
Von Flatern,
no.
President Anderson?
Aye.
Hines?
He is excused.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 24 ayes, 5 noes, 1 excused.
That amendment has passed. The next amendment for our consideration is amendment number 10, third reading amendment number 10. I'd ask that be read in at this time.
Senate file 1, third reading amendment number 10. Budget 335, local government distribution.
Senator Dockstader, would you like to speak to the amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. President. I move third reading amendment number 10 to Senate file 1 and ask for your favorable consideration. Mr. President, members of the body, we took a look at things after the close of work a couple of days ago and felt like this was a better fit for the overall picture of what's happening in this building in regards to our funding for towns and counties. I reminded you of the losses that they're going through over the past 2 years, and I remind you, too, that this is not an ongoing fund. This is a one-time assistance for our towns and our counties, our local governments. They appreciate what's been happening, how they've been helped along the way. That's been noted, and they appreciate that, but they need some additional resources to help them get through the rest of the biennium. The past 2 years have been very difficult for them, while at the same time, it's been very good for the state of Wyoming. We're in a good position right now, fellow senators, to help our local government. This is approved. It'll help them address the problems with what's happening with the sales tax, too. I noted for you a couple of days ago that the recovery is not strong enough or broad enough to help our local communities and our local counties. We've been given an opportunity now to help those people who are out working on the front line, an opportunity to help our mayors, our councilmen, our county commissioners. As you notice on this budget amendment, we're deleting the budget that was approved by my colleague, and I'll have him address that in just a moment here. But it is the same as we spoke of 2 days earlier, $10 million distributed through the city and town direct distribution allocations, county direct distribution allocations, city and town revenue challenged allocations, and county revenue challenged allocations. I'd ask for your favorable approval. These are the people who are out there on the front lines working for you in local government.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Yes, indeed. I believe that this is probably what the local governments are more desirous of, so I don't have any problem with this, and I'd support this amendment.
Other conversation, other discussion, questions? This is a go ahead, Senator Bernard.
I would like to rise and speak for this amendment. It will really make a difference for our cities. And I've heard personally from my own city. I've heard emails from around the state on this, and so I really hope that we can support it.
Okay, other comments or questions? Senator Dockstader, would you care to rise again on this?
Oh, no, just asking for your favorable approval.
Okay, this is movement, and I would ask that for the yeas and nays, and to Chief Clerk call a roll on this, please.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case? Case?
No.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Amrick?
Aye.
Esquibel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert? Hicks,
aye.
Hines,
aye.
Jennings,
aye.
Johnson,
aye.
Landon,
aye.
Martin,
aye.
Meyer,
aye.
Nicholas,
no.
Nutting,
aye.
Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Ross,
aye.
Rothbus,
no.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
oh.
Von Fleitern, President Anderson.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 25 ayes, 5 noes.
By your vote, third reading amendment number 10 has passed the Senate. Next amendment for our consideration, third reading amendment number 11. The reading clerk will read that in at this time.
Senate File 1, third reading amendment number 11, section 343, data center recruiting.
Senator Nicholas, would you like to move the amendment? Speak to it, please.
Thank you, I would, Mr. President. And I move
third reading amendment number 11.
Third reading amendment number 11 to the Senate file. Mr. President, what this does, there is an Attorney General opinion that was just recently issued that said the data center would be an industrial facility requiring industrial siting. And because apparently all these electrons are combining and processing and creating industrial reconfiguration inside the building. Obviously, there are two things that happens when you do industrial siting. One is it requires extensive permitting, it could require some scrutiny that we think, frankly, is not appropriate. The flip side of it is that if you do go through the industrial siting process, there's a mechanism to pay the community for the impact of that through sales tax by carving off sales tax and delivering it to the community. Seems to us that both processes are probably not appropriate for this facility. So what this does is goes into that bill and specifies that these data centers do not have to go through industrial siting, notwithstanding they may exceed that limit. I'd urge your support.
Questions? I'll go to Senator Schiffer, and then I'll go to Senator Von Fleitern. Go ahead, Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, recall the Industrial Siting Council process is to help local communities accommodate when an industry moves in. And I'm not sure whether I need enlightenment that there will be no impact to the local community from this. And that's in terms of sewer and water and fire protection, all those kind of things. Let me suggest, and this just off the top of my head, I'm fairly literate in computers, as Mr. President knows, and if these big banks of computer gear, for example, fire, it's a very serious fire because of what's in them. It isn't all friendly stuff inside a computer. Some of it can be very dangerous, and we need to look at that and say if they need, for example, and what comes to mind immediately is special air-breathing equipment for the fire crews and those type of people, and I worry some for the residents of that fair city if they don't have an opportunity to address those kind of things.
Senator Von Fleitern.
Thank you, Mr. President. I think I'm against this. I wish I could divide it, but it's not written so it is divisible. But I will say that if they're not paying taxes up front, I don't think we should rebate the local community the additional sales tax that's generated generally by an industrial project. But the siting council procedure, if you look through 3512.101 through 109, which is what we're exempting here, is where you find out those problems. Do they have fire protection to match this size building? You find out what the school systems, do they have enough classrooms? Is the impact of new employees going to be that great that you need to, that your schools aren't there, they can't handle them? It goes through things like preliminary evaluation of or plans and proposals for alleviating social, economic, or environmental impacts upon local governments or any special districts. Well, you won't know this. They will come in, they will submit plans, they'll build it to building codes, which we agree will happen. We're talking about a very large, reputable company, probably. But you'll never go through the checklist here, which is scenic resources, recreational, archaeological, land use patterns, economic base, housing, transportation, sewer, water, solid waste, police and fire, educational, health and hospitals, water supply, and other relevant areas. That's what that process is all about. How big of an impact? This is huge. That town itself, should it be located over there, already tells you they don't have that kind of workforce there and they're going to build it. Well, when you change the whole demographics of a town, you must have quite an impact. That's what that process is there. And we could probably go with the fact of sales tax increase if they were to get that part of the impact, because they're not paying sales tax, so I don't think there'll be much.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think it is divisible, and I'd like to see if I'd like to ask the chair if he would agree with me on this. I think the first division would be on line four, beginning with after B there, the letter B in parentheses. The first division would start with data storage and would go down to the end of that sentence on line eight at the period act, and then the second division would be that next sentence, starting with no impact, all of line 10, and ending with center on line 11.
I believe that is divisible.
And
go ahead, and do you want me to repeat the division?
Yes, please, Mr. President.
Okay. Quest has been for the division. Division 1, starting on line 4, starting with little b, going through that sentence down to the end of the sentence on line 8, ending with at the end of the period after act. That's division 1. Division 2 would start with the word no at the end of line 8 and go for the remainder of the amendment ending on line 11 at the end of the word center. So that being division 2. With that, would you like to go ahead and address division 1, Senator Perkins?
Yes, Mr. President, thank you. And for the reasons the good senator from Campbell County just talked about, this is a very, very large, we've had the neighborhood of, I think, $4 billion thrown around. That's a large impact on a community. The industrial siting process is intended to provide the opportunity for affected counties to go through that, to understand what's going to happen, and affected municipalities to go through and understand what's going to happen, what those burdens and benefits will be associated with that, so they can make adjustments, ask questions, or at least know what's coming on and have some input into that process. And so with that, I would ask you to vote in favor of Division 1 for all the reasons that the good senator from Campbell County just gave you.
In regard to Division 1, I'm going to go to Senator Scott first on Division 1. Senator Scott. Sit down, Mr. Perkins, or Senator Perkins. You'll get your turn. Go ahead, Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I have a question, and it applies equally to both halves of the division. And that is, what we're doing here is we're making an exception to an existing statute. And there are some limits as to what we ought to do in a budget bill in amending statutes. Now, Mr. President, over the years, some of those limits have been honored mostly in the breach, but they are there, and I would like a little discussion as to whether or not this is a proper amendment in the budget bill or whether it goes too far into the business of legislating in the budget bill. And, Mr. President, I do not have an opinion on that subject except that I think it is right on the line and we ought to think about it. In that regard, Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I do share the concerns that this is fairly substantial legislation working its way through a budget bill, even though it would last for 2 years, but it's a companion kind of legislation with respect to earlier legislation that was considered on a standalone basis and did pass through the legislature, which actually granted an exemption. It kind of strikes me that we grant as an exemption, and then we come in here, and the source of revenue for impact assistance may have been diminished, but now we're trying to say there's going to be this gigantic impact on this county, and yet we don't want them to go through the process that we've established in long term to deal exactly with that impact. And I think it points to two things. One is, it probably has found a goof here that we had to fix, and this was the last vehicle on it. But it is not appropriate, Mr. President, to do substantive law or to deny a county the impact assistance that it's due to have when they face the impact of such a large facility coming into their area.
Members of the body, in regard to the discussion as to whether or not this is an appropriate amendment, I could probably do one of two things. I could call a meeting of the Rules Committee and allow a smaller group to decide, or I could leave it to the larger body to decide, and you could simply vote your conscience in regard to the amendment. If you feel it's an inappropriate amendment, then you could vote your conscience that way. Barring any objections, I'm going to go forward with this on the floor, and you can, through the larger body, decide by your vote whether or not you think it's an appropriate amendment. The amendment has been divided, and so I guess we would then continue on in discussion with the division, and again, you could vote your conscience on either division. Senator Nicholas, this would be your first time, I believe, on the division.
Thank you, Mr. President. When you look at the Industrial Siting Act, the word industrial, what an industrial facility, is not defined in statute. And my intent in bringing this amendment is simply to express our view that a data center is not an industrial facility. For example, the NCAR facility here, the Walmart distribution facility, which had just as much or greater impact on this community, it did not require or go through the industrial siting process. The industrial siting, industrial facility in my mind, is a facility that emits gases, a smokestack, one that has environmental impacts. A couple things about this, the data centers. One, the data center wants to be inside the city limits. So they'll be inside the city limits. The city will have every opportunity to do whatever controls they want. The facility is simply a large warehouse of computers. No different than the Walmart facility out here that houses, and my guess there may be as many computers out in the Walmart, and we probably shouldn't use that name. And this, there are a couple big storage facilities around this community that have large storages of computers and all types of equipment. There's electricity going through here, and I submit to you this is not an industrial facility. And this community wants to recruit this facility quickly. They want to be ready for them. The industrial siting can be an enormous barrier. Now, it's an appropriate barrier for things that, and I agree, if you believe that they were disposing of their plastics there, maybe different, but they're not going to do that. It's just a big house with big computers. We have a data center at the university that has large data facilities. We have large data banks over in the Emerson building. We have a data bank storage over here in the Hersler building. I don't suppose any one of you have walked through there and wondered whether you're safe because there's a bunch of electrons being processed. You have your computers here. And in this instance, part of the effort is simply to recognize and to interpret. This is the only way we get to interpret it right now, because the issue didn't arise a month ago. If the issue had come up 2 months ago, we could have brought a bill and defined industrial siding. But we as a body, I believe, have the right to interpret our statutes through the budget bill, and frankly, I don't think a big, large building with a bunch of computers in it is an industrial siding. And you take these facilities, they all had large employment levels. We'll deal with the employment. But I think part of that is that if you're going to exempt, then you're not entitled to the payments that come with it. We'll live with that consequence. I'd love to have the payments that come with them, but I'm more interested in getting this business here. And I live in a community where, frankly, I don't think that it's appropriate to subject them to that permit process.
Further commentary in regard to Division 1. Go ahead, Senator Driscoll.
I'd like to address in general. I would like to request that we get a chance to see the Attorney General's letter. We just heard a really eloquent talk about why it wasn't one, and we had reference to a letter that said it was one by the Attorney General, and I'm wondering if we're capable as a body of overruling the Attorney General's opinion just by another opinion on the floor. I'd like to see the letter, and I'd like to know if they talked to the governor about this before it came up.
Further commentary in regard to Division 1, Senator Von Fladern.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm against Division 1. Industrial facility, according to the statutes, means any industrial facility with an estimated construction cost of at least $96,900,000 as of May 30th, 1987. And we're talking billions here. So I don't see how this is not under the Industrial Siding Council. And having such a huge impact, it should be analyzed. It should be analyzed under all the criteria that you find in the Industrial Siding Act. So I ask you for your no vote on Division 1.
Senator Meyer, Division 1.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I'm looking at 3512.113, and they talk about stuff here like $10 per short ton of solid waste, including radioactive waste, and $5 per short ton of solid waste, and these are minimum things that you have to have deposits and a waste management system. You know, I think the good senator from Albany County is right spot on this thing, that there's a lot of these sections in this particular area that where they just don't match up hand in glove with the data center. You are really talking about power plants and things like that, where you're going to have some serious environmental impact, and that's really the main case for the siting council in their review. We've got a lot of businesses that come into our state, and if we're going to use the commerce clause of the Industrial Siding Council to reach out in all areas and say just because it's a big business that now you have to come under our jurisdiction, we're really playing like the federal government on some of these things. This is kind of a power grab that I can see. I just don't think it's warranted, and I stand in favor of this division.
Second time, Senator Von Fladern on the division.
For my second time. It also says they're going to be inflated, and I think the inflation cost now is a facility over $165 million, which is way over. And I can say you can probably go to about any facility that's been built recently that has not come under this is less than $165 million. And when we talk about waste and radioactive and dumping cost and all that, that falls under the fact that this Industrial Siding Council is anything over that amount of money and also includes, regardless of construction costs, these other facilities, incinerators, incinerates or disposes of unregulated materials, blah, blah, blah. Those are instantly, whether they're $1 to construct or several billion. But any construction project over about $165 million, which I think is the new inflated value, should go through this siting. Against Division 1.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I was here in Wyoming and running a state agency during the last boom period when we had major construction going on, a lot of it in the western part of the state. We're talking about holes dug in the ground. We're talking about big plants outside of them to grind the stuff up into white powder, plants to desulfur oil, massive things like that. And I participated in it because they had an impact on the libraries out there, and so we went out there to see if we could get some help from these companies for that impact, along with the educators and everybody else. It was quite an interesting era in Wyoming. I don't look at this as the same thing, Mr. President. I look at this as something entirely different. There's no thousand-man man camp here. There were thousand-man man camps out there. There were several of them in the western part of the state, and right now they're just empty prairie. They packed up and left. So this is a whole different ballgame than the one that we had in the 70s and early 80s. And I would agree they should be exempt, and I would ask you to vote for this.
Senator Rossless.
Thank you, Mr. President. On and for the amendment, First Division in particular. We have to look at both words here, and we have to consider this concept, industrial siting. We're talking about the definition of industrial facility, and one of the problems we're running into when we're looking at this definition is that it begins with defining industrial facility as an industrial facility which. So there's a little bit of circular definition here, and I think that's leading to what the concern is. So there are some details about the finances, and in fact, when it goes on and has an explicit list, it talks about power, companies, utilities, major burning facilities. The intent of an industrial facility and looking at the impact or the potential impact of it is when a specific community or county can't on its own handle that impact and needs additional help from the state. The reason typically for that is going to be because of the waste streams, the environmental impact, and types of things that leave the building, that concept. And it has to do with what you consider when you think of the term industry or industrial. Now, if anyone in here was really picturing a bunch of computers on a rack when they think of industrial, I'd be surprised, because that's not what this is intending to look at. And as we have heard in other testimony, we have a lot of facilities that have been going in around the state that have not been subjected to the industrial siting policy or scrutiny, and the reason for that is because it's fairly obvious that that's not the intent of the law. This is an instance where, as we just heard in the previous speech, all of a sudden we have decided that we want to be sort of the heavy hand of the state government here and get involved, where realistically this is just certainly, Mr. President, an area where the industrial siting review was not intended, and with that I'd urge your support of the amendment.
Senator Case?
Well, I'm kind of confused, Mr. President. It's not the first time that, you know, when if we're talking about a specific facility, and there was testimony offered in the Revenue Committee about the size and the impacts of this facility on the county where it might possibly go. And I'm here to tell you those impacts were substantial. And literally, I'm not making this up, Mr. President, there was a witness in the committee who said that the impact would be the same as if you leveled the university. Every piece of property and building and structure associated with the university and rebuilt it. And then you still wouldn't be there. I'm not making this up. That was what the testimony that was offered in committee. That's pretty gigantic impact on a locality that kind of drives right at what the Industrial Siting Act is all about. And then here we are in a budget writing substantial legislation about this. So the question is, if it doesn't really have any impact, it's no big deal, and it's just benign, and it's just going to slip right through and be no problem, how does that jive with the testimony that we received when we granted this tax break in the first place?
Any other comments in regard to Division One? Any other comments? Then sponsor of the amendment can take his final shot. Senator Nicholas.
Yeah, thanks. Well, Mr. President, this is not an industrial facility. It is a very large commercial facility. It's going in a commercial zone. And for anybody and those of you involved in your city, county, local governments, you know the difference between a commercial facility and an industrial facility. This is going in a commercial zone. Now, let me talk to you about attorney general opinions. Been there, done that. What ends up happening, I didn't know there was an attorney general opinion being drafted, but in this case, the agency, the industrial siting, in order to power grab, to have more relevancy, goes over to a young attorney and says, I want a private opinion. And I'd like you to, and by the way, I think this is industrial because all these electrons are colliding in here and manufacturing things just like you're making shoes or shirts or whatever, a slaughterhouse or whatever.
Now, and Nicholas, these are sensitive issues. Why don't you address the chair, please?
Thank you. So with respect, Mr. President, to the issue with regard to I'm also a lawyer, and I look at the same issues, and frankly, I just respectfully disagree with the opinion. This is a large commercial facility with an impact. An impact alone, that you can have large impacts like large warehouses with 300 or 400 employees that are not industrial. They're commercial. And we have the right as the legislature to put our 2 cents into this. Now, if the Attorney General doesn't want to abide by it or if they want to bring a lawsuit to challenge it, fair enough. And I have talked to the governor's office and the governor's staff that's on the policy advisor agrees with us. He thinks it's an insane opinion. Nobody's bound by it. But with respect to us, we have the opportunity to say, no, this is a commercial facility, but it's not an industrial facility. I'd urge your support.
Senator Perkins.
Well,
we looked that rule up, but I'll give you this latitude. Go ahead.
It's okay.
Mr. President, as we talked to initially, well, I certainly was going to be using sometimes, maybe I'm still going to use it, but, you know, when you look at this, there definitely was some more thought. I think this was important in what it is that we're going to do here. And what we're doing is we're actually saying this data processing.
Thank you. Without objection, I'm going to call for a voice vote on this division. All those in favor of Division 1, which starts on line 4, little letter B, and goes all the way down to line 8 and ends with the period at the end of Act, that being Division 1. All those in favor of this division, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
That division has passed. We are now on Division 2. Division 2, beginning with the word no on line 8 and going to the remainder of the amendment. So who would like to address this? Senator Scott, would you like to speak to that
Mr. President, this had potentially the same question as legislating in the budget bill. I think we've set a precedent with the amendment we just passed, and I just ask the Senate continue to be governed by that precedent and remember it in the future when we have some other needs that may arise.
Any other commentary in regard to the second division? All those in favor of the second division, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
That's close. All those in favor, please stand. All those opposed. Division 1 or Division 2 has passed. Third reading amendment number 11 has passed the Senate. The next amendment for our consideration, third reading amendment number 23. Reading clerk will read that in at this time.
Senate file 1, third reading amendment number 23, budget 346 AML funding.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move second reading amendment number 23. Folks, this deals with the STEM building that's already in the budget. We had extensive hearings with respect to the contractor preferences for constructing buildings. And it turns out there's an anomaly in the law that if the state of Wyoming, these are AML funds. So with AML funds, if the university builds the facility, you cannot apply contractor preferences. But if the state of Wyoming is the contracting agent, you can apply contracting preferences. Now, having learned that, and university came off with a great experience with A&I in building the joint labs over in Laramie, and what this does then will move the construction of the STEM building from the responsibility of the university over to A&I, and as a result of that, we will be able to employ construction or contracting preferences. I submit to you it's more likely to help the contractors here in Cheyenne that have felt like they've been frozen out of some of that work. And the university has, they drafted the opinion, drafted the language on my behalf and said we're willing to do that. They think it's important to try to direct this work to Wyoming contractors. Some of the last buildings, I'll tell you, there were absolutely no Wyoming contractors on the, you want to go over and look at that business college. And you wouldn't see anything but a green or other type of license. So we're doing that. The other thing it does is with respect to the Lewis Street, which is between the proposed construction and the university, we've softened the language and provided more guidance to the university and to the city to try to find a way to turn that street into something that's part of the campus and safe for students. In the original language, we said we'd like to see it vacated, and what we made sure here is that there are sewers and water. They need to have some facilities going through there. But with all the students that are now going back and forth there, we simply want them to develop a plan for Lewis Street that's part of the university and make sure it's a safe and pleasing environment. We now have two buildings north of Lewis. The university has acquired all of about four or five pieces north of Lewis all the way to the following street. This actually softens the language that was in the original budget. For those two reasons, I'd ask you support the amendment.
As I read the amendment, there's no monetary effect other than changing of agencies. So with that, I would ask all those that are in favor of this amendment to say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. That amendment has passed. Third reading amendment number 23 has passed the Senate. The next amendment for our consideration is third reading amendment number 12. I'd ask that be read in at this time.
Third reading amendment number 12, budget addition to 300 sections.
Senator Perkins, would you like to address that, please?
Thank you, Mr. President. I move third Third Reading Amendment 12, Senate File 1, and ask for favorable consideration. Legislators, what we have here is ultimately one of the victims of the cutbacks in local government is programs like DARE and others of those that educate young people. What this appropriates $100,000 to the Department of Health to go out and to be used by law enforcement agencies to promote the following law enforcement agencies or other nonprofit organizations which provide prevention education related to either bullying, cyberbullying, or internet safety, prescription over-the-counter and other drug abuses or addictions, decision-making and positive healthy choices. What this is mainly intended is for the DARE program and some of those other programs like that, but obviously it's broader than that and it will be available to other nonprofit organizations as well. We probably have some people here who may have gone through DARE program, and certainly most of our kids had. You can decide if that's worthwhile or not and ask you for your favorable consideration. Thank you, Mr. President.
Other questions? Seeing none, go ahead, Senator Christensen.
Mr. President, I'll rise on and in support of this. You know, it's I think it's money well spent. You look at that amount of dollars and one or two people making wrong choices that changed the course of their life could gobble that up in a heartbeat. And so when that money spread around in these kind of programs, this is a great investment into our future.
Other comments in regard to this amendment? Seeing none, I'd ask the Chief Clerk to call a roll in regard to Third Reading Amendment number 12.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebelt?
Aye.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Amrick?
Aye.
Esquibel?
Aye.
Geist?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks? Hines, Jennings,
no.
Johnson,
aye.
Landon,
aye.
Martin,
aye.
Meyer,
no.
Nicholas,
no.
Nutting,
no.
Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
no.
Ross,
no.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer,
no.
Scott,
no.
Von Flatern,
no.
President Anderson,
aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 19 ayes, 11 noes.
By your vote, Third Reading Amendment number 12 has passed the Senate. The next amendment for our consideration, Third Reading Amendment number 13, I'd ask that be read in at this time.
Senate File 1, Third Reading Amendment number 13, Budget Addition to 300 Section.
Senator Coe, would you like to speak to that?
Yes, Mr. President. I would move Third Reading Amendment number 13 to Senate File 1. Where this amendment comes from, you know, members of the body, is that during the interim when the Select Committee on School Finance or the Recalibration Committee, one of the key issues that we were attempting to do was to go in and be able to really look at the different components of data that we had to have to make our decisions. And if you think about the budget, or the budget for schools, if you think about the block grants that are out there, out of $1.4 billion, 82% of that goes to salaries for teachers. And we requested data from the Professional Teacher Standards Board and were unable to get the data back. We had a consultant hired. He came to our meeting and he said, you know, they couldn't provide any of this for us. So I bring you this amendment through frustration. Now, I want you to know that, first of all, the Professional Teacher Standards Board, this is only till June 30, 2012, the end of the biennium. It brings in the superintendent, and if need be, the governor, to make sure that we can secure that data that we so direly need. Now, as the process, and it's in the amendment, so I'm going to refer to the Senate File 70 and House Bill 127 process, we need data. This allows the superintendent to oversee and request the data that we have to have. I can't tell you how important data is to have when we start down this process. It goes in and it says that they shall, in paragraph I, shall submit data elements collected from public school administrators, teachers, and other school district personnel to the Department of Education for housing in the department's database. And I can't emphasize how important that is. We absolutely have to have good data to make our decisions.
That's what the amendment does. I bring it to you from frustration in the interim. A lot of discussion on the PTSD. I think that maybe this will, you know, fire a shot at them and say you've got to start cooperating when we go out and request this data, because it's so very important in K-12 finance. I'd ask that you support the amendment.
Senator Nicholas.
President, on and for the amendment, folks, we can't engage in the process of accountability without having the data that the PTSB puts together, and they're the licensing board. We had a hearing on this just recently on another bill that's going through here, and the Attorney General has advised that we're entitled to all that data, that is Department of Education. But we have this tussle going on, and that is we have a licensing board that kind of wants to keep the information to the teachers, and yet they're all being employed by, virtually all of them, by the state of Wyoming. And we can't conduct our efforts without them, so then part of we had considered making amendments just to move that into Department of Education. Throughout the United States, there's different forms. Some are inside their Department of Education. Some are outside as part of independent boards. This arrives at least for now, a good solution to the problem. Will allow the PTSB to continue to operate as an independent board. The board, by the way, is appointed by the department or the state superintendent, and allows them to serve as an independent board, but make sure that we get the data. And then, of course, if we don't get the data, there's a capacity just to move all that funding into the Department of Education to accomplish our needs. They had terribly antiquated computer systems. They had records by employees that, honestly were filed by their first name. So if you wanted to find information about the teacher, you'd go to their first name to locate it. And we've already spent a lot of money, nearly close to $100,000, in the recalibration effort to move to digitalize this information, and the process then just stops when we're done. We can't afford to have that. We've got to continue to move forward with it. And this is an appropriate mechanism to make sure that we have success in our process. And another bill is coming through. We're providing more funding for this process to make sure that computer systems are antiquated, but are not antiquated, that they'll meet our needs. So I'd urge your support.
Senator Rothfuss, would you like to go ahead?
President, I'm neither seeking clarification, Mr. President, about my understanding of the PTSB is that the bulk of their finances come from licensing fees from the teacher or the various teachers as they're getting their teaching certificate for that year, their license for that year. Now, as I'm reading this, we're going to instruct the Superintendent of Public Instruction and potentially the Governor's Office with the ability to withhold funds from an organization that, to the best of my knowledge, we don't fund to a large degree. And I would just ask the question of the Chairman of Appropriations of how much money does the state, through the general fund, appropriate to the PTSB relative to the amount of money that they receive through the licensing fees, because I'm probably just misunderstanding how this is going to operate, Mr. President.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, my question goes to the suitability of this being in the budget bill in the first place. We discussed on an earlier amendment about the idea of legislating through the budget bill. This has nothing to do with the budget bill. It has nothing to do with any money involved. And as a matter of fact, going by what the sponsor said, this is a result of frustration in the interim. So I'm curious as to why he didn't just bring a bill. Why is this a third reading amendment on the budget bill?
Good, Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President, with respect to the first question, I think it is the licensing fees raise about $1.3 million. I think that's a year. There are about seven employees in there to engage in licensing, but they collect a variety of data that you are going to be required to have in your longitudinal analysis. Without it, we can't serve. Now, we are going to augment their funding through other mechanisms, some bills that are coming through because we recognize that we're asking them to do things that they probably don't need to do simply as a licensing board, but we need to get that data more suitably delivered to us. What we want to do is try to create, I think that the idea here is let's see if we can figure out a collaborative effort where where the teachers can have their own PTSB board and give it a try during the next 2 years. If that doesn't happen, I think there will be a bill to come through to say we'll just move them into the Department of Education. But for lawyers licensing, for example, we pay our licensing fees, and believe me, there's a lot of information that's provided to the state about licensing attorneys and things like that. It's not uncommon that you'd have these shared features simply because your licensing fee doesn't exempt you from being involved in a variety of state functions. So I guess you could have brought a bill to say, look, let's move this into the Department of Education. But that would have created its own set of problems. We'd had to sort out what's right and wrong. We want to try to do a collaborative effort for a period of time, but we can ill afford to be here 6 months with all of the investment we have in the education system in this accountability, and find out next summer that we can't do any of our studies because we can't get the data from the only people that house it. So it's pretty important that we at least have an understanding that this information needs to be delivered, or else we will stop the funding and we'll redirect it to Department of Ed, and they can provide us the data.
Senator Rossless, for your second time, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. President. It is my second time, but I'm still a little bit concerned about this. So, you know, I'm not solidly against it, because I certainly respect, Mr. President, the fact that for the legislation we're bringing forward, we definitely need to have this data available to us, and I'm hopeful that we get support on that from the PTSB. But it's just my concern over how we're looking at this. There was a bill that was brought forward to bring the PTSB into the Department of Education that died in committee. So that happened, Mr. President. The concern there were some problems with that concept, and this is resolving a lot of those problems. But what I see this as, which is kind of alluded to by my good colleague from Albany County, it would be like if the Wyoming Bar Association was told by the state, if you don't give us the information, we're going to take your funding. Well, I'm not sure we can do that. It's good to be the state and all, but I'm not entirely convinced that we can do this, or that if we were doing this, it would have a lot of enforcement. Now, if it's true, Mr. President, that we're going to give them money later, and that this is then going to allow us to withhold that money if they don't do what we want, then I guess we've got the sort of carrot and stick that we're going to need. But I don't see either of those two entities right now, Mr. President. But that said, maybe this is the best we've got, Mr. President.
Other commentary or questions? Mr. Minority Leader. Other commentary, I'm going to go to Senator Hicks and then to Senator Scott.
Mr. President, just one distinguishment between this and normal boards is you have to realize it's a professional licensing board, but they're licensing people that are deriving their funding and their revenue with state tax dollars. So it's a little bit different than a complete professional licensing board. So that distinguishment needs to be made.
Senator Scott, you like to speak?
Mr. President, with regard to the question of whether this belongs in the budget bill, it seems to me that this is
even more appropriate in the budget bill than the amendment we passed a few minutes ago. And I thought that was establishing a useful precedent. I didn't realize, Mr. President, we were going to need it quite so quickly. But this one does relate to budgets and funding and how to manage the budgets. So I would argue it's even more appropriate in the budget bill than the one we passed a few minutes ago.
Other commentary from the floor? I'd like to go back to the sponsor.
Well, Mr. President, just briefly, there isn't any way that this amendment's going to go in and take their money because it's only subject to review. Subject to review by the state superintendent. That's all it says in there. The other reason I think it's appropriate in this budget bill, if you go to your goldenrod, you'll see where there's money profiled. I think for Senate File 70 and House Bill 127, and that's in the amendment. Senate File 70 is the accountability bill. House Bill 127 is the recalibration bill. This is tied directly to that. So I think it is appropriate in this budget. I'd ask that you support the amendment.
All those in favor of this amendment, third reading amendment number 13, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Senate, third reading amendment number 13 has passed the Senate. The next amendment for our consideration is third reading amendment number 14. I'd ask that be read in at this time.
Senate File 1, third reading amendment number 14, addition to 300 section.
Senator Jennings, would you like to move and speak to the amendment? Go ahead. You may have it. Sorry. Go ahead, Senator Nutty.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to introduce visitors from Leadership Cheyenne. They are having their leadership of the legislature day today. They're in the balcony behind you, and their organization seeks to identify prospective and current community leaders. The participants learn more about community, gain numerous networking opportunities. They're exposed to additional community leadership skills and develop an understanding and desire for greater civic trusteeship. So if you will, help me to welcome them.
Welcome and enjoy your day. I would ask the reading clerk to read that third reading amendment 14 in again, please.
Senate File 1, third reading amendment number 14, addition to 300 sections.
Senator Jennings, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move third amendment reading on Senate File 1, amendment number 14. I reluctantly bring this to you. Thank you. You've already heard the arguments on this bill. It was a bill that went out of here, went over to the committee on the other side. A young lawyer type started picking it apart, got a no vote on it, realized that he really didn't want a no vote on it. Someplace else there's somebody else working on a budget that is going to, now that young lawyer type is going to put it up, and so he wanted me to bring it over here. I'm satisfied with the fact that it was voted down in the committee and I'd bring it back at a different time. They're not. Vote it up, vote it down. It's up to you.
Question being called. Third reading amendment number 14. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Third reading amendment number 14 has failed the Senate. Third reading amendment number 18. I'd ask that be read in at this time.
Senate File 1, third reading amendment number 18, addition to 300 sections.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move third reading amendment number 18. Folks, this does not spend any money. This is what it does. We have two accounts that exist out there. One is the Omnibus Permanent Land Fund, and these are funds that were set up to have funding in it so that we could go take care of our state institutions. And we could appropriate money out of that fund. In fact, about 3 or 4 years ago, we appropriated monies for the state institutions for their maintenance. There is a second account out there, which is called the Omnibus Permanent Land Fund. It's the income fund. Now, first, the Permanent Land Fund has about $29 million in it right now. The other account has about $7,100,000 in it. The difference is with respect to the statute, the second account, the income fund, those funds could be expended by the SLIB board without consultation, without appropriation by the legislature. So they are funds that were designed to be able to take out an emergency to go address the problems with the institutions. Well, we have now a sizable major maintenance fund that's out there that were for our state institutions that's administered through ANI. ANI has a substantial contingency account. And it seems to me under these present circumstances it's appropriate to move the $7 million from the income fund into the permanent fund to make sure that these dollars are expended with legislative appropriations. So it just makes sure that the dollars, the expenditures have to come back to us. I'd urge your support.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I think I support this, but I want some assurance. From time to time, we have used this account. A couple times I remember a state institution, actually it was for the elderly, we had as I recall, it was a boiler that went down, and and we had to replace it right then. No messing around. And that's why it was geared, so that the State Land Investment Board could send that money out and replaced, as I remember, a boiler. I also remember one other time, and it seems to me it's comparable to a boiler. I don't remember exactly what it was. But that was the purpose of this account. Is the $100,000 that's going to stay in there, is that going to be enough, the just-in-case situations?
Other questions before the sponsor answers that one? I'm going to call in Senator Case first. Go ahead, Senator Case.
I think, Mr. President, you're just going to punch that thing out here one of these days. And thank you, Mr. President. I'm asking questions about the interplay of the income account and the permanent account and how it might relate to, for example, we used to have a Board of Charities and Reform, and it's my understanding these accounts are related to those obligations that were wrapped up from what the Board of Charities and Reform had to do. And in that sense, Mr. President, while they're not school land trust accounts, they are still trust accounts with respect to what used to be the functions to maintain and to care for our state institutions, which I think probably still exist. Those functions still exist, even though the trustee is different now. So I guess one question I have is that characterization true? And then secondly, if there is land that is sold and that was originally under the Board of Charities and Reform, where does that money go when it's sold? Does it go to the general fund, or does it go into one of these two funds? It seems likely to me that it should go into one of these two funds. I'm just trying to understand how this works and how this accumulates money over time.
Other
Thank
questions
you, Mr. President.
Before this? Okay, Senator Scott. Chairman, following on those questions, the money's going into the Omnibus Permanent Land Fund. Is that one of these constitutionally protected funds or protected the act of admission or something, where we cannot then withdraw the principal and spend it if we have a problem where we need buildings? Or is it something we can appropriate out of and spend if the right kind of contingency arises?
Other questions of the sponsor? Quite a list of questions, Senator Nicholas. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is a permanent fund. It is not a constitutional fund. It's ill-defined with respect to, this is the corpus, is ill-defined with respect to what you can and can't do. We have appropriated monies from these, from the permanent fund, within the last 4 or 5 years, specifically for Evanston improvements, and I think it was the roof we did. So we have a history, while it's ill-defined, we have a history of having appropriated legislatively money out of the permanent fund for the institutions. And I think you're right, it is for I have to go back and re-research the sources of the funds, but I do believe that the Some of the land dollars do go into, if they're sold, go into this permanent fund, but those dollars can still be expended, unlike the permanent mineral trust fund or the common school permanent land fund, so they don't have that stature. With respect to the $100,000 that's remaining, the reason why it seems to me that we have sufficient monies out there, you'll recall we just increased the contingency fund and the variety of the, or two funds that the construction, the state construction manager has, between the two, there's almost $8 million, $7 million there to address contingencies. In addition, we have now, unlike in the past when we began in this second or this new mineral run, we are now setting aside substantial amounts for major maintenance for all of our institutions. So it seems to me that we have a young SLIB board coming in. There's a $7 million out there that could be spent by them. All we're doing is moving it into this permanent land fund so that if there's a need, they've got to come back to ask us for it, and we'll appropriate the dollars. And in the meantime, there is, I believe, ample resources out there to deal with any problems that we could deal with. But it's a policy question. I mean, it's up to you. No strong feelings.
Go ahead. I'll ask another question. Go ahead, Senator Schiffer.
Both times when we went in and took, the legislature took money out of that fund, we paid it back by allowing each of those institutions to hold part of their Medicaid funding reimbursement and put it back into that fund rather than reimbursing the general fund or anything like that. So the account is whole from both of those projects.
Thank you for the clarification. This is a transfer between funds, and I would ask for a voice vote. All those in favor of this amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
This amendment has passed. Third reading amendment number 18 has passed the Senate. Our final amendment, third reading amendment number 1, corrected copy, I'd ask that be read in at this time.
Senate File 1, third reading Amendment Number 1 to Corrected Copy, addition through 300 sections.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. President, I move Third Reading Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 1. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not an appropriation. It doesn't spend any money. It simply creates a new coffee can account. So we're taking $15 million that would be flowing under the present profile into the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account. We're moving it into a brand new account that we will create. It will be back on the back of the goldenrod, and it'll be described as the Municipal Solid Waste Landfill account. This is not the account that's described in a bill that you've seen going through. This is a legislative account set up inside our accounting system for the within the budget reserve or the general funds. And all what we're saying here is we'll put in $15 million to start with. The money will sit there unless there is a legislative appropriation of the fund. And we ask the governor to include at least $15 million a year into the fund in future years. And it's the intention of this amendment not to spend the money, but to begin the process of saving and creating an amount of money to meet what we think is going to be about a $250 to $270 million obligation sometime in the future. We don't know how it's going to be spent. This is for the landfills. Nobody's had a solution to whether we do tipping fees, whether we raise fees to deal with these. And it's just a beginning of a planning process. Once again, I have no strong feelings about it. I think that it is a policy decision. Do we start to begin the savings? So it doesn't appropriate it, doesn't spend it, just creates another account, a copy can, if you will, for that, and starts to set money aside for that purpose.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. President. And I, too, would encourage the body to give your careful consideration and support this amendment. We've had a report that I discussed earlier and has been presented to you, prepared by the Department of Environmental Quality, and that liability out there is somewhere between, on the low side, we think $150 million, on the high side, $250 million. It's out there. It's real. We're going to prioritize. We're going to come back, and nothing happens without this body and the full legislative approval. I think it's a good plan to be thinking about the future, and it's proactive, and let's start setting aside these funds and see where we are. It's certainly a lot easier to start now rather than 2 or 3 years from now when we see the size of this potential problem. It's huger than we thought, and then we were looking at a large appropriation. Let's start now, and let's prepare for the future. I ask for your support.
Any other comments? Senator Landon, and then we'll go to Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just have a question of the sponsors. We've dealt with 3 or 4 issues like this where we talked about splitting monies aside or leaving them in corpus accounts. I'm not familiar enough with what we do when we set up a special legislative account like this. Maybe we could have a little more information about what sorts of interest, dividends, is it all lumped into the same thing? Or would we be better served to put this $15 million right in there with the rest of our rainy day account funds, and just knowing full well that in the back of our minds that we've got this liability out there? This is a little bit unique, creating a new account like that. Just wondering if we're still going to be getting those kinds of returns on our money and et cetera.
Senator Case, before we go back to the sponsors.
President, I actually don't know if this is a good idea or not, but I think there's a policy question here with regards to the Senate and our position on voice votes versus roll call votes. I think this basically sets the money aside. It doesn't actually create an appropriation in and of itself, but I think it kind of takes us down that road a little bit, and I would ask the chair for the A's and nays, and it's not really a reflection on the bill, but I just think it's a policy question where we are setting aside a certain amount of money.
Thank you. We will do that when the time comes. Other commentary, I think there was a question of the sponsors from Senator Landon. Either one of the sponsors would like to address that question. Please go ahead. Senator Nicholas.
President, I'd like to answer those questions. With respect to this account, it's simply an account that the treasurer sets up downstairs. And it's like an identification account. The money gets placed in there. We have a variety of ones. You call, for example, we talked about the Capitol Building or the Capitol Building Facility. It's just an account. The money's put in the account. I identified that. With respect to this amendment, I intentionally did not draft it so that the interest would go back into it. The reason for that is that it's just part of the pool of funds, and it's invested in the same pool as is the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account. That's what we call our pooled revenues. All the interest goes into the general fund, so there's no special accounting to put more interest back into it. It's a simple feature. The treasurer looks out and says, well, I've got some money here. I know I'm going to have at least a year. I'll put it out in my year investments, and it's part of the pooled investments. So it doesn't change anything with respect to how the money is managed. But it does, I agree. I think my colleague from Fremont County is absolutely right. It begins down the process of earmarking some funds to solve a problem in the future. My proposal and with the staff is that we'll put this on the goldenrod so the account will be identified. People won't forget it. It'll be there. And then we begin just the process of putting a little bit in every year. And the purpose of it is so that when I'm gone, all of us are gone, and they have that liability, they don't have to go out and raise a huge $100-$150 million. We do it incrementally. It's up to you. Thank you.
Yeas and nays being requested, I would ask the chief clerk to call a roll in regard to third reading amendment number 1.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Emmerich?
Aye.
Esquivel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Hines?
Aye.
Jennings?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
Meyer? Nicholas?
Aye.
Nutting?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Schiffer?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Anderson.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 28 ayes, 2 noes.
By your vote, first reading or third reading amendment number 1 has passed the Senate. That is our final amendment. We are now back on the bill. Is there any further discussion in regard to Senate File 1, the budget bill? Seeing none, Senate File 1, having been read 3 separate times, the question is, shall a bill pass? The chief clerk will call the roll.
Barnard. Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
No.
Case.
No.
Christensen.
No.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Dockstader.
Aye.
Driscoll.
No.
Emmerich.
Aye.
Esquibel.
Aye.
Geis.
Aye.
Hastert.
Aye.
Hicks.
Aye.
Hines.
Aye.
Jennings.
No.
Johnson.
Aye.
Landon.
Aye.
Martin.
Aye.
Meyer.
Aye.
Nicholas.
Aye.
Nutting. Perkins.
Aye.
Peterson.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye.
Rothfuss.
Aye.
Schiffer.
Aye.
Scott.
No.
Von Platern.
Aye.
President Anderson.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Closing vote. Christensen, no to aye. Driscoll, no to aye. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 26 ayes, 4 noes.
Senate File 1, having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, Senate File 1 has passed the Senate. Senator Nicholas.
President, I may have the privilege of the floor.
You may. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we have worked awfully hard this afternoon. We kept people in their seats. Perhaps, if I may, we could have a suggestion of a brief break here before we go on to other business. Go ahead, Senator.
Mr. President, I move that we stand, that the Senate stand in recess for a brief break to come back and begin our work on Committee of the Whole.
We will stand at ease.
Okay.
So, yeah, that would be, I see what you're saying. Rather than take it, they just take the credit. Yeah, okay. All right, hey, that's cool. I like that. Yeah. Okay.
And we want to go down that road?
Follow the money. That's where the policy is.
Well, I'm taking a break.
Damn.
Here's your... Then it'll come to order. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business for consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself into committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion is carried. Senator Martin, would you like to come take the chair, please?
Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 7. The reading clerk will read the House bill.
House Bill 7, Wyoming Veterinary and Medicine Practice Act 2, an act relating to veterinarian, sponsored by the Agriculture Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, and Public Lands and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye. Senators Bebout, Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Geis.
Chairman, I commend the whole rise and report. I move House Bill 7, and I'll yield the floor to Senator Emmerich to explain the bill.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you have a copy here, I'll kind of take you through this. This bill addresses three things, or four, animal emergencies, duties of the state veterinarian, most importantly, continuing education for veterinarians, and then some cleanup language. On page 2, there is a new definition of animal health emergency that will fit into some of the duties of the state veterinarian. There's also on top of page 3, Romanet 7. This is more of a Good Samaritan law and freeing individuals from undue law enforcement. In the next Romanet 13, excuse me, this defines more the duties of the state veterinarian. So we can respond to animal emergencies. Hopefully we will not have any in the state of Wyoming. But it does allow the state veterinarian to deputize veterinarians within the state and also from other states should things arise. Lines 15 through 23 of page 3, this merely defines the Board of Veterinary Medicine and how they shall be paid. This is long overdue because the original Practice Act was from the 1970s. As we go down on page 4 and along the line, we are actually removing the state veterinarian as the Secretary Treasurer of the Board. We are part of the Professional Licensing Board in A&I, and they take care of all of the accounts, the minutes, and things of this sort. And by removing the state veterinarian from the board as a voting member, he will be remaining as an ex officio member since he is appointed by the Livestock Board. As we go through the bill, you'll notice the secretary treasurer has been stricken and replaced with board. This is just cleanup verbiage to clarify what is going on in the bill. This continues on page 6, page 7, on the top of page 8 there is a establish some new rules that will give us some verbiage that allows us to have a grace period in license renewal. I know of a veterinarian who for 2 years has never received any notice that the licenses were about to expire. And I've had considerable difficulties with that problem. In line 14, probably the most important part of the entire bill. It refers to the renewal under this subsection and a continuing education requirement that is established by the board. Oh, approximately 25 years ago, when I was on the board, we asked if we could institute continuing education requirements. We were assured by the Attorney General at that time that we could. Subsequently, we have been informed that we could not and had to place it in legislation. 33-32-14 just addresses violations, brings them up to date. They are misdemeanors. And this is just cleaning up and providing for the continuing education, which is, I mentioned, probably the most important part of this bill. I'll stand for any questions if you have any.
Any more discussion? Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Geis' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 7, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 7 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 8.
House Bill 8, Wyoming Traditional Food Act, an act relating to food, sponsored by the Agriculture Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Driscoll, Geis, and Hicks. No, Senator Emmerichs. Senator Geis, Chairman.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move House Bill 8 with a due pass, and I'll yield the floor to Senator Bebout to explain the bill.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate Wyoming Traditional Food Act, I bring this to you to clarify some statutes that pertain to what we consider to be the traditional food events that we all have in our communities. And several years ago, one of these traditional food events that we're very familiar with, a church bazaar, was notified by a representative, a state agency, that they, in fact, were not exempt, and there were certain regulations that they had to comply with. And after having understood and seen what those regulations were, they canceled the bazaar. And so this purpose of this is not just that, but to clarify really what goes on and what the law is pertaining to the Wyoming Traditional Food Act. If you look at the bill, Mr. Chairman, and you go into the definition section on page 2, we define what a traditional event or activity is. And, Mr. Chairman, it's very important to understand that we're talking about potentially hazardous and not potentially hazardous foods being served at these traditional food events. We go on to define what those are, but not limited to, on line 18 for family and non-paying guests, on line 20 for weddings, funerals, potluck, dinners, charitable dinners, and charitable cook-offs or functions, and then there's a definition in our statutes 357110A29 that has a definition of a function. Continuing on page 3, it's for sale or donated foods which are prepared for consumption, and the sales are sponsored by a nonprofit entity as a fundraiser. Item D, for outdoor activities such as picnics, barbecues, roundups, camping, or outdoor work conducted by employees or volunteers. Mr. Chairman, on line 9, by utilizing kitchen equipment provided by employers as a convenience for the storage and preparation of foods for consumption on premises by employees and non-paying guests. And, Mr. Chairman, I would submit to you that when we had lunch here today that it could be argued that we're violating a law. This clarifies that in our own Senate food room. Mr. Chairman, going on to line 14 on page 3, we define who it applies to, and it package or labeling required by any state governmental agency or any agency of any political subdivision of the state. And, Mr. Chairman, there is a Committee of the Whole amendment to clarify that I will talk about a little later. Mr. Chairman, on page 4, we get into the definition of establishment. And currently the definition, if you look at it, is under 357110A11. It talks about displayed for sale, manufactured, processed, packed, held, or stored. You could argue that one of our kitchens, in fact, is an establishment. If you look in our statutes, that means that establishment is subject to all kinds of inspections by the Department of Agriculture. We go on to define establish in lines 15 through 18. Does not include a home kitchen where food is prepared and stored for family consumption, or any other place equipped for the preparation, consumption, and storage of food on the premise by employees or non-paying guests. We wanted to be sure we included the non-paying guests. Mr. Chairman, the rest of the bill, if you look at it, on 357119, 357-121, 357-124, go into specific statutes that, to make it very clear that those requirements of packaging and labeling, examination and licenses do not apply to a traditional food event. Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Meyer.
Chairman. Page 4, line 18. I'm trying to understand how we're actually looking at our little room across here where we do pay a little bit at the end of the session. And so we would be considered a paying guest in that circumstance. And then things like a free will donation where people are actually paying, or a chili cook-off where you might have a mic? The mic on?
Shows its own.
Okay, or a chili cook-off where you may have a donation jar or something like that. I'm trying to distinguish how those things would be, handled.
Senator Meyer, could you get closer to the mic?
Well, can you hear me now? Well, so the question is on non-paying where you have free will donation or where you have an assessment at the end of a time period or a chili cook-off or something where maybe dollars are thrown in a jar and they're counted up to see who the prize winner is or the public's choice or something like that. Different things. I'm wondering how how the establishment actually works in there and how that would work in those cases and whether we got those guys covered for sure.
Further discussion? Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the sponsors, and it comes as no surprise, I think, that they already know that my county health officer is against this bill. And quite frankly, I don't know enough about what's already exists in law and or regulation to be fully apprised and of the facts before I vote on this bill. But in reading from an email that I received from him, he says that the bill seeks to exempt activities which are already exempt under current food regulation. Private parties, church potlucks, weddings, funerals, roundups are already exempt from temporary food permits, licenses, and inspections. The preparation of food for these private events may occur anywhere and in any manner without intervention. So I'm just wondering if that's accurate or not, and if it is accurate, what is this bill really doing?
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll take the last questions first, and I guess it's a difference of opinion. When you really look at the statutes under potentially hazardous or non-potentially hazardous foods, they are, in fact, not exempt. And you read the language of the law, the definition of establishment, and the situation that I brought to your attention relative to what happened in my county where the Department of Agriculture felt, based on the existing law and the rules they had in place, that they had that authority, which is the whole reason for the bill. Now, I will also say, Mr. Chairman, that there is one difference that this bill includes that has not been in the statutes before, and that's to allow the definition of potentially hazardous to be included. And potentially hazardous, Mr. Chairman, let me find that, is defined. Potentially hazardous is defined as any food which requires time or temperature control for safety to limit pathogenic microorganism growth or toxin formation. So this bill says if you have a traditional food event, that it's not only for potentially hazardous but non-potentially hazardous food as well. So that is a change. So what you have, and the example that I talk about is, and I will use, say, a funeral, for instance, where people bring to that funeral after the services, and you'll have a gathering, and they might bring a turkey or a roast or some meatloaf. Well, that is potentially hazardous, and this bill will specifically exempt them from being labeled, inspected, and licensed if they're prepared at home for that type of a traditional social event. And that is a matter of public policy that we have to decide here. I think it's a personal responsibility of people when they go to those kind of events to understand that, rather than having people come out into our home kitchens to regulate, license, and inspect if I'm going to prepare a turkey for a service after a funeral. And that's the purpose of that. As for the definition of non-paying guests, my colleague from Goshen County brought up that the intent of this is to show that it's not for sale. So, and my understanding is if we had our particular situation here where at the end of the year we pay for the food, that's not a for sale purpose or a commercial enterprise, and clearly there is a difference. And that's the way it was drafted. That was my understanding. The testimony we heard in the committee, and this was came from the Department of Agriculture, because they were concerned that we might get into that gray area of commercial and sales. We do not want to do that. That's why we put non-paying in there.
Representative Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I rise.
Senator Landon, excuse me.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. And I do appreciate the sponsors for bringing this. I think that we've probably all heard of situations where perhaps there's been a little overstepping of the bounds. We certainly had one a couple of years ago up in my neck of the woods, trying to cook some hamburgers for some students before a rodeo, and had that shut down, which was kind of surprising. But I do, as the sponsor knows, I represent a county in which we have a public health official who's very much against this bill. I just one of the concerns that that official has expressed is the fact that there's a bigger percentage of food difficulty outbreaks, you know, that happen at events like this than there is, for example, out of a restaurant or whatever. And just wondering if you had much testimony on that in front of the Ag Committee with regard to what dangers that does pose. Maybe a little bit more on that. Thank you.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I know when I'm beaten, but I've got a public health department that does not like this bill either. I think the important part to remember is those counties with home row, we can have public health departments and they can establish rules and regulations. This originated from some overzealous inspectors. And, you know, you can't legislate common sense, but we're trying. But I think we need to take into consideration, for example, our little food room. It's not open to the public, therefore it is not under scrutiny. This, everything that the definition is really important, as far as I'm concerned, to define open to the public. And I also don't want to upset little Lutheran ladies, but I will have to tell you I'll vote against it.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, we did have some testimony in committee that spoke to the issue of the relative frequencies and outbreaks in these events versus restaurants. And they had a couple of instances where they had some outbreaks that there was a lot of people involved because of the improper cooking of some turkeys. But some of the questioning that went along those lines is, then if we implement these regulations on these home-prepared traditional foods, is that going to preclude any future outbreaks? And if that's the case, there would never have been any in any restaurant in the United States, because they're really well regulated already. So I guess that was part of the testimony and the questions and answers is we're probably going to have foodborne illnesses no matter how much we regulate these, because even with restaurants and commercial things, you can't preclude this from happening. So it really comes down to how much regulatory enforcement do you want to put down on grandma's kitchen to feed people at a funeral. And again, a lot of you're willfully doing this. Nobody's making you go to these events. So what we saw in the testimony, that there was potential cases and a couple occasions right here in Cheyenne where there was a very 30 or 40 some people. We also asked that there was also a number of restaurants around the state of Wyoming that also had infractions where we had foodborne illness. So by not doing this doesn't mean that we're going to stop these things.
Senator Geis?
Mr. Chairman, there's about six towns around the state that are home rule. Cheyenne, Casper, Jackson. Can you hear me? Okay. Anyway, and then some of those also have an MOU with the county. Laramie County, I think, has an MOU with the city of Cheyenne. So some of you guys are worried. You go talk to your home food inspector because you're under home rule. I think there's a couple more counties that and cities that have that, but I can't name them right now.
Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One further question. It seems to me that at one point in time, the political party that I belong to had an event, I think it was in your community, for the good sponsor, in which a lot of people got sick, and some very, very sick. How does this bill would this bill touch that situation?
Senator Bebout.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thought I was prepared for any question I might have, but you caught me. Actually, that was catered. And since it was catered, it was commercial, they are under the Department of Agriculture rules and regulations. And on a sidebar, I missed the particular lunch because I was doing something else for the party that day. But anyway, that was regulated, and they were inspected, and that would not have any effect with this particular piece of legislation.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, I think that event was classic. That's actually what does happen is a vast majority of these, they have problems, are at events where the food is away from the kitchen, and that's what they're addressing. And back to what the good senator from Bags had to say, those are going to continue to happen. Those, whether you're regulated or not, when you pack food up in a portable container and move it somewhere, you have problems. I can tell you in our community, it's a tough deal. We can't sell food at our ball games anymore. They can't sell hot dogs. You can't bring stuff from home. We don't have cookies anymore. Don't have pies anymore because they've got after us. And I'm telling you, for me, I want you to pass the bill so we can go back and I can get my neighbor's cookies at the deal, get to buy a pie. There's a buyer beware deal. You know, when you get food, be it in the break room in here or at the local deal, you look at what you're doing. You look at who's preparing it. And you use some, back to what the good senator down here said, some common sense. If it's been sitting there for 3/4 of the ball game on the counter with flies buzzing around it, you probably don't want to eat it. You use your own common sense. If you don't want to eat it, don't eat it. But give us the chance to be able to have it and use our good common sense to eat it.
Senator Johnson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, thought, what, a couple, 3 years ago when we passed a bill that when I was on committee number 5, that took care of this, and it took care of overzealous statewide people. I guess it didn't. We had an assurance from the appropriate agency that it would. Oh, that's too bad, but I'd just like to tell you about something that surprised me. I'm a historian and a librarian, and I always thought for many years that before the age of antibiotics, the things that killed most people were infections and tuberculosis. Of course, when antibiotics came along, they pretty well took care of those. I was wrong. The vast majority of the people in this world were killed by bad food. And they were killed early.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, there is a committee hold amendment. I would ask it to be read in.
Reading clerk will read in committee the whole amendment number 1.
House Bill 8, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 3, line 16.
Mr. Chairman? DeBout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Number 1 to House Bill 8. And members of the Senate, I bring this to you for the purpose of, as we were just talking about, to clarify in this particular statute the issue of home rule. And, of course, it's in our Constitution, and we got into some discussion with our LSO staff about whether a city is a political subdivision or a political subdivision of the state. I think it is a political subdivision, but not necessarily a political subdivision of the state. And there were some issues there. And so to clarify it very clearly, if you look at the amendment, what it says is any city or town may provide for licensure, permitting, certification, inspection, packaging, or labeling pertaining to the preparation of serving, use, consumption, or storage of foods at a traditional event upon the adoption of an ordinance for that purpose. So, Mr. Chairman, what we're doing here is if the community of Cheyenne decides that they want to have a health inspector and he wants to go ahead and do what he wants to do relative to his inspections of these, and if he wants to talk to the ladies of the church about their bazaar, and if he wants to shut down the Little League barbecue, then he can certainly do that, and the city council does it, and it's home rule, and have at it. What we're trying to do is there's a lot of communities that feel like we don't want to do that, and that's the purpose of the law. If they change their mind, they certainly could do that, and we clarify the home rule issue, I think, once and for all. And Mr. Chairman, it goes on to talk about it, and the chairman of the Ag Committee talked about there are some MOUs that exist out there between the cities, the counties, and we go ahead, and the language that's already in there is it shall not preclude any agency from providing assistance, consultation, or inspection when requested by the traditional event. If you're confused about it and you want to talk to the department, they will tell you. Then it goes on to say further that an agency from providing assistance or consultation to any city or town within the municipal boundaries of the city or town pursuant to a written agreement with the city or town. That's already in place. They are doing it now. We didn't want to get into that issue because if they want to do that, that's fine with us. I would ask for your consideration.
Some further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 8, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 is passed. Senator Geis.
More standing committee amendment number 2.
Will the reading clerk please read in
House Bill 8.
The amendment. Committee of the Whole Amendment.
Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2 to engross copy, page 5, line 21.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Geis.
I move standing committee at number 2, and all we're doing is moving up the date for one of the completions. Because I received some phone calls from around the state that there's events that will take place before July 1, and they just wanted this to be legal when they do it.
Any discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Geis' motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 8, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That amendment has passed. Any further discussion on the bill? All those in favor of Senator Geis' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 8, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Committee of the Whole, House Bill 8 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 20.
House Bill 20, Medicaid Reimbursement of Services and Act Relating to Medicaid, sponsored by the Select Development Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye. Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so the recommendation that House Bill 20 do pass. Mr. Chairman, there was a standing committee amendment which makes some fairly significant changes in the bill, and what we want to do is have the bill explained by the proponent first, and then we will ask that the standing committee amendment be read in, and I'll move it and discuss it. So at this point, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to yield to Senator Peterson for an explanation of the House bill.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 20 is the third, the marching orders that the Select Committee had to deal with during the interim, and this was the third and final order that we had to deal with, and it was basically pertaining to the LLCs and family members participating or providing services to other family members, a son, a daughter, or other. And years ago, the problem came about as the advice to these family members that were performing these services to these other family members was to form an LLC and actually pick up other clients. And this was for mostly the outlying areas away from facilities that would provide these services automatically for these patients. And so these families in these outlying areas, or perhaps a family member who weren't satisfied with a provider or services in their locale, they were advised to form up these LLCs so they could qualify for the waiver and receive some participation or help financially for the services they were providing. About a year ago, the Department of Health asked for an Attorney General's opinion on if this was within statute and legal within our state, and the AG's opinion was no, it wasn't. They were still considered family members and could not be subsidized or receive funds, the waivers, by providing for other family members. So now the problem was that we had LLCs formed, parents providing services for sons and daughters and others, perhaps four or five other patients under this LLC umbrella, and now they weren't receiving a waiver for their very own son or daughter. And so it caused a problem. We were assigned the task to try to remedy the situation. So here is House Bill 20 in the attempt to remedy that situation. It basically is authorizing payment to relatives or persons with developmental disabilities or acquired brain injuries. And on page 2, you'll see the language. On line 8, we specify that unless the relative is a family caregiver providing services under a home or community-based waiver program. And we went so far starting on line 12, defining on what a family caregiver is or what it means. And on line 16, they still will have to be meet the requirements for a qualified family caregiver as established by rules promulgated by the department. Family caregivers shall be certified by the department in the same manner as non-family caregivers. In other words, for these services and facilities around the state that have to meet those same qualifications, these LLCs or these family members will have to meet those same qualifications and be certified. And then finally, on line 21, the department shall amend the state plan and apply for a waiver from the Centers for Medicare services as necessary. So hopefully this House Bill 20 will take care of the situation that we presently have and the Attorney General's opinion and make things better for these LLCs and these family members providing the services for their other family members and receive the waiver that is necessary to. And again, this is mainly for outlying areas. During the interim, the testimonies that we heard on our select committee were numerous of family members that had formed these LLCs in outlying areas far removed from any services. And so it was just an effort to try to keep their loved ones at home. And if any of you have friends that are in the same situation providing those services, you'll know that it's very rigorous and it's very time-consuming and it is very expensive. It's very expensive, and my hat's off to them. And this way the state can help and assist in providing that waiver for those families in this particular situation. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for questions.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I ask the Standing Committee Amendment be read in at this time.
House Bill 20, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 2, line 9.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, when we heard this bill in committee, it became quite apparent that a system had sort of grown up in this state, and frankly, the state agency and some of the parents involved trying to deal with a difficult situation where services for some of these developmentally disabled people, who sometimes can be very severe, were simply not available or were not satisfactory for the individual involved. And it was apparent that what had happened was that Bendis' advice has been described to go form an LLC, and yeah, we can contract with an LLC. They had done this, and then quite a number of them had said, okay, we're taking care of our own family member now, but we've got a business, and we can take care of other people. And it had grown into a set of small providers, often in very rural areas, where we have a real need, and they were meeting a real need. And then somebody made the mistake of asking the Attorney General for an opinion, and we find that the bureaucratic I's are not dotted and the T's are not crossed, and it's not proper. So the bill, as it came to us, said, okay, we're just going to say you can take care of family members. Well, that opens it pretty widely, and your committee was afraid that there were likely to be some fairly significant financial consequences for the Medicaid program if that happened. And we said, well, what can we do to preserve the current system, which seems to be working, does not seem to have adverse consequences, but without going the next step and throwing it wide open? And that's what this amendment does, Mr. Chairman. It comes in and says that the services could have to be provided through a corporation. We did broaden it to just a corporation, which may be an LLC, which corporation a relative may own, and that fits right in with the language there. And so with this, if you adopt the Standing Committee Amendment, you'll preserve the current system, which does not seem to be given to abuses, which does seem to be increasing the amount of services that are available in our rural areas, without throwing it open to everybody coming in and turning themselves into a family caregiver and getting frankly compensated for something they're going to do anyhow. It's kind of a mixed system. It probably wouldn't work in a larger state. You'd probably get some abuses of it, but I think for Wyoming, for our circumstances, it represents a good solution, one that preserves the system that has grown up and proved to be quite beneficial, that deals with the bureaucratic problem, because it's not a federal regulation. It's the feds said, okay, you know, up to you guys in Wyoming, but the state law has got to authorize it. So you pass the amendment, pass the bill, the state law will authorize what's happening now, and everything hopefully will be fine, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to, that's a quick summary, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think I might just need some more explanation, perhaps, on the intent of this amendment. Because, Mr. Chairman, what I'm seeing basically is that the bill is trying to address a problem. And then, as I see it, this amendment is basically trying to add an additional layer of bureaucracy to make it more difficult to address the problem, and we're hoping that the additional bureaucracy will discourage use of the program. That's kind of what I see, but I'm not entirely sure that's a noble purpose. We see in the bill, as it's written right now, family caregivers shall be certified by the department in the same manner as non-family caregivers, which leads me to believe that we already have a relatively high threshold, hopefully. You know, I don't know enough about that process, but it seems like there has to be a process there. So I'm just looking for a little more explanation on this concept that we're going to throw the door wide open. I don't necessarily see the danger yet, and I'm hoping that the sponsor of the amendment can provide some more clarity on why we want to add to the bureaucracy and what we're really trying to prevent, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, we felt that when you did away with the additional step of you got to go out and form a business, that that would then be an invitation, and we'd get a number of people coming in qualifying as family caregivers for care that they are now providing on their own, and that we would have a significant impact on our Medicaid budget. We did not care, Mr. Chairman, to do that. That's what the bill without standing committee amendment does. It seemed that the current system of asking people to actually take the additional step of forming a business and behaving like a business had two beneficial effects. Number one, it enabled us to take care of some of these difficult situations. And number two, when we asked them to take that additional step, sure enough, most of them, not all of them, but many of them, behaved like a business and took on some other clients. And that, in our thin provider situation, is very useful. So what the Standing Committee Amendment seeks to do is simply preserve the current system. What the bill seeks to do without the Standing Committee Amendment is to change the system and open it up, and I think there would be significant financial consequences. But that's my judgment. You all make your own judgment.
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. And just one more point of clarification from the sponsor. Could you comment? I don't know the process, Senator, when it says family caregivers shall be certified by the department in the same manner as non-family caregivers. And admittedly, that's just the fact that I'm not familiar with the process. I would just like some a better understanding of how rigorous that process is, what it takes to be certified, and basically how high is the bar on that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, there is a certain degree of rigor to it, Mr. Chairman. You have to get CPR certification. There's a number of things you have to do. It's not an impossible barrier by any means. I would guess that probably any member of the Senate could do it if they cared to devote the time and energy to it. And a lot of these people have real motivation to do it. We had testimony in committee, Mr. Chairman, from a member of the House who had gone through that certification and had been giving respite care with that kind of certification, and a few years ago decided that, you know, it takes something to keep the certification up, decided that it wasn't worth the bother, that it was too much of a burden. So it is some burden, but there's probably enough money at stake so that a significant number of people would go through it. So it's a partial barrier, but I think still you'd have, even with that certification requirement, absent this form of business requirement, you would have a significant expansion in the family caregivers, and our Medicaid program would take a financial hit. With the Standing Committee Amendment, where, frankly, it's a compromise between the we don't allow them at all and we're going to throw the door open, and I think it's a good compromise.
Further discussion on the amendment? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 8, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion to adopt Standing Committee it's House Bill 20. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 20, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. House Bill 20 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 50. Reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 50, Health Insurance Exchanges, an act relating to the administration of government and the 2010 federal health care reform, sponsored by the Labor Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schaefer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Fladeren, no, Senator Hastert, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move with the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so the recommendation that House Bill 50 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
House Bill 50, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 1, line 7.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, to understand the Standing Committee Amendment, I have to first explain the bill briefly. Mr. Chairman, this bill relates to health insurance exchanges. Now, health insurance exchanges are one of the things that the national reform provides for. There's two different models for these exchanges. One is the Massachusetts model, where the exchange is basically a way where you pass out government subsidies for health insurance and seek to get more people enrolled. The second model is the Utah model, where they developed an exchange and passed it before the national reform, where the exchange is designed to facilitate the working of the private market by allowing, making comparison shopping among health insurance a good deal easier. And both models are permitted under the national reform, and the state has the option of either having them or saying, no, we don't want to have them, and then the feds will do it for us. And there's some people around with strong feelings that that would be a mistake. There's some other feelings that we aren't big enough to support one of these exchanges, and if the feds want to do it, let them have at it. So there's two opinions on that. Mr. Chairman, several of us went to the National Conference of State Legislatures annual meeting this past year and getting some of the money's worth out of our dues, and we heard presentations on these exchanges from both Massachusetts and Utah who have practical experience with it, and the unanimous advice was these things take some time to put in and do right. This is something you've got to pay attention to and get started on. And what's happened is the feds made available grants of up to $1 million per state to work on developing these. The previous governor had our state apply for, and we did receive a grant of $800,000 to finance basically the work that we're talking about in this bill. The Joint Committee brought the bill, Mr. Chairman, as a way of involving the legislature in the decisions that are going to have to be made here, getting us ready and participating in those decisions. So it isn't strictly an executive branch function. Mr. Chairman, and here I get into the Standing Committee Amendment. Standing Committee Amendment does two things. First, there's the engrossed bill as opposed to the bill as introduced. They changed the committee that is investigating these things and made it more of a legislative committee, Health Insurance Exchange Steering Committee, and then you see the list of the who the committee was. They provided that the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House would appoint co-chairman for the committee. What the problem with that is, the grant was given assuming there was going to be an executive branch task force. Now, that has two legislators on it. And what the concern was that this might either negate the grant or be a parallel effort. So what the standing, what your Senate Standing Committee amendment did was say, okay, we will honor what our brethren in the other house were trying to do, but we'll have a, first we'll call it a task force, and we'll have the change in name at the time on October 1st when the current grant expires and we get a new one, so we won't jeopardize the current grant. Simple as that. And we said we'll have, instead of two co-chairmen, we'll have the two co-chairmen appointed by our presiding officers, Mr. Chairman, and we'll let the governor appoint two co-chairmen. And essentially, you'll have four co-chairmen, and effectively, they'll act as an executive committee for the larger group. And that seemed to be, that was well received as a workable way to make this work, not jeopardize any funding, and get a continuing group, and it will be continuing, that will proceed to deal with this issue. The other thing the Standing Committee amendment does is there are in the bill as introduced several provisions that the feds would not fund. And you can see them there on page, start on page 5. One of them is evaluate whether there's a reasonable opportunity for successful litigation to prevent the federal government from proceeding. There's several of those sort in there. Feds ain't going to fund anything like that. So what your Senate Standing Committee amendment did was took those out, and that enables us to delete $145,000 appropriation on page 6 to pay for the things that the federal grant wouldn't pay for. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. That's the Standing Committee amendment. I urge adoption of the Standing Committee amendment. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any discussion on the amendment? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the Standing Committee amendment, number 1, to House Bill 50, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion to adopt Standing Committee of the whole, Amendment number 1, has passed. We're back on the bill. Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 50, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 50 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 80.
House Bill 80, Service of Process in Family Violence and Stalking Cases, an act relating to service of process, sponsored by Representative Davidson. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee Whole rise and report, that do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 80, Service of Process and Family Violence and Stalking Cases. And for an explanation of the bill, I ask you to call on the good senator from Sweetwater and Uinta County, Senator Cooper.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 80 relates to the service of process for out-of-state service for family violence and stalking cases. Mr. Chairman, this bill had been requested by the magistrates and the judges, mostly in those bordering counties of our state. A stalking order is begun by a petition, and which this is not exactly the same as a motion of order, so the full faith and credit provisions of the state and the federal legislation really don't apply. But when a judge serves a petition across the state lines, there really isn't a problem, you know, getting it served. But what is happening is after the defendant returns to the state, his or her defense attorney are telling them, you know, that they can return back across the border to the state in which they came from because the Family Violence Protection Order or stalking statutes don't apply across state lines. The judges haven't been able to find anything in current statutes or rules of procedure that apply to the service of petitions. So we need to make it clear in the statutes through this amendment that a stalking order or a petition can be served outside of the state, and the Wyoming Rules of Civil Procedure will allow it. And as you can see, if you look on the bill on page 2, lines 2 and 16 and 18, and also on page 3, lines 8, we've added the words either within or outside of the state in order to take care of the concerns of these judges and magistrates. And Mr. Chairman, that explains the bill.
Discussion on the bill?
Question.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 80, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 80 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 81.
Not being an attorney.
House Bill 81, Vacant Land, an act relating to property, sponsored by Representative Dave Zwanitzer. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a do-pass recommendation on House Bill 81, Vacant Land. And, Mr. Chairman, there's a Standing Committee Amendment. If we could have that read in.
House Bill 81, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 1, line 15.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 81. This all has to do with the definition of vacant land to be used in our property disclosure statement. And for an explanation of the bill and the amendment, I would yield to the majority floor leader.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, House Bill 81 is a fix to our disclosure statement statute, which is 34-151. And what the statute provides for is that there are certain things that a seller must disclose when selling vacant land. And so paragraph A, which is not in the bill, says except as provided in subsection B, which is allows the buyer to waive the disclosure. There are certain things that the seller must disclose, but nowhere in this statute do we ever define vacant land. And so what this bill does and what the Standing Committee Amendment with it does is basically say is define vacant land, meaning that there's no habitable dwelling, Romanet 1, Romanet 2, not within the boundaries of a platted subdivision or city or town, and now 3, which is the Standing Committee Amendment, and is less than 160 acres. Now, the purpose of the Standing Committee Amendment is that when you're buying a big piece of property greater than 160 acres,
you probably don't need to disclose all of this stuff. And so if you're buying, you know, a parcel of property that is 200 acres or whatever, you wouldn't be subject to all this disclosure stuff. And so with that, I'd call for a question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question on that one at 160 acres. Does this have any implications in any other statutes as far as taxation or anything like that, or is it primary, or is this vacant land used only in conjunction to disclosures?
Senator Case?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This is only an area of property disclosure. It's specifically the subsection is called Property Disclosure Statement. And really what it's saying with the Standing Committee Amendment is if the property is bigger than 160 acres, you don't have to disclose availability of water and sewer, availability of fire protection, et cetera, because that ought to be a buyer that it ought to be able to determine that themselves by the fact that it's already a large parcel. There's no representation. Now, that ought to be a pretty sophisticated buyer. And it's not part of being a subdivision or anything like that, just a big piece of ground. And it doesn't impact taxation.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, there's a sometimes you have, school sections or whatever, Section 36, and it's a little bit smaller, and some of those have changed hands, and it's kind of the catch-all. It might be 157.83 or something like that. And I just wonder if there's, I remember the last time we were looking at definitions on land, rather than going right at a 40, we went to 35 so we could take into consideration whether there was a road that went through it or whether there was a small little carve out or something like that. So yeah, the intent was that it was a large block of land, but these folks that had 159.53 acres, versus 160, and I wonder if there's any discussion along those lines as far as the flexibility, and perhaps we come back and say it was 158 or 157 acres, so we could take that into consideration.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Well, the bill as it's brought forward, of course, says that the vacant land is property without a habitable dwelling and not within the boundaries of a subdivision, city, or town, so it's property that's just sitting out there. And that would be property that you would have to disclose on. And then the Standing Committee Amendment just picked out of the air pretty much a size and said, hey, if you're bigger than that, let's not worry about disclosure. That's, if you're buying more than 160 acres, you're in the big leagues, and you're going to figure this out on your own, and there's a lot to that. Now, if you want to make 159 acres, there's no magic because I don't think it's tied to anything now. If you recall, we have the ability for counties now to pass an ordinance that says that allows them to regulate so-called large subdivisions, large acre subdivisions. And we chose a size that was less than 160 acres for that. I don't remember exactly what it was, but there really is no connection. I don't think anybody would have heartburn if you brought it 10 or 15 acres either way. I don't think that's really the issue.
Senator Scott.
Chairman, the intent in committee was to use the quarter section as the defining piece, and frankly, I forgot, being tired, that, yeah, we fitted a square survey on a round surface, and some of these quarter sections are significantly less. So I'd look it up in the subdivision, the large subdivision, and use that figure. And I think it would be entirely consistent as a second reading amendment with the spirit of what the Standing Committee Amendment was.
Further discussion on the amendment? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 81, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 81 has passed. We're back on the bill. All those in question being called, all those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 81, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 80 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 88.
House Bill 88, Guides and Outfitters, an act relating to guide and outfitters and the Wyoming Board of Outfitters, sponsored by Representative McComey. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, reports with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Esquivel, Senator Burns, Chairman.
Senator Burns. There's a purpose for that.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 88, Guides and Outfitters. There is a standing committee amendment, and I ask that it be read in now.
House Bill 88, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 1, line 3.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Standing Committee Amendment, and for an explanation of both the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment, I ask that you call on the good Senator from Cody.
Senator Coe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it was back in the early 90s when I chaired the TRW Committee that we created the Board of Outfitters and Guides, and back then, the intent was to bring some stability to the operation, particularly as it related to unlicensed outfitters. What this, and I think, again, in the early, around 2001, I think we relooked at the statute. But this is just the intent of this bill. It's not about changing any policy in our outfitting and guide operations in the state, but rather updating the statutes to reflect current-day operations and advertising practices, and further provide public protection from unlicensed outfitters. I want to emphasize that the bill is intended in no way to restrict the rights of private property owners, and I believe this bill probably does that and maybe more. This bill, along with the committee amendments, does two things. It provides express authority to the board to investigate unlicensed outfitting and allows the board to deny or issue a license. Now, I'll talk about the committee amendments when I get to the standing committee amendment. Just to go through the bill quickly, if you go through the bill on page 2, line 8, paragraph little I, it's simply adding a definition of advertises. And this is needed because of the explosion of the World Wide Web and the ability for anyone from anywhere to advertise outfitting and guiding services in our state. Page 2, line 17, defines guide services. Page 3, line 22, defines outfitter of record. Now, this is important in order to have a point of contact for an operation where the owner of the business is not a licensed outfitter. Now, up in my country, it's not unusual for somebody from back east to come in and go up in a hunting camp up in the thoroughfare and think, boy, this is a neat deal. I think I'll buy this camp. And that has happened quite a bit. But they are not the licensed outfitter. Page 4, line 18, defines take. Or defines take. Page 5, line 8 is all cleanup language. Page 5, line 12C is added to protect the public from someone advertising services who is not actually licensed to do so in the state and to exempt landowners. Page 6, line 15 allows the board to investigate alleged violations of the statutes, that being 23.2407A. Which is on page 5. Page 7, line 3, allows the board the ability to require the complainant to appear before them. This is may and not a shall, so the board has discretion here. Page 8, line 10, allows for the board to require a licensee to pay damages or may refuse to issue or renew, suspend, or otherwise discipline a licensee. On page 9, line 1, it references those statutes. These are all game and fish licenses. So that's the bill in a quick and dirty. I will tell you that this is a fragile industry anymore. I don't know if my friends over in Teton County would say that, but I can tell you in my country, We're having a terrible time up there. Some outfitters are just struggling to survive. It's a whole different hunting experience, particularly with elk out there today. And elk are being moved around by wolves, and I actually know outfitters that are getting ready to fold their tents, and I think the same thing's taking place in Jackson. With that, Mr. Chairman, that's an explanation of the bill. Answer questions, and then I'll go to the Standing Committee Amendment.
Any discussion on House Bill 88? Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the Standing Committee Amendment
takes out on page 1, you'll notice it says after services, delete the balance of the line. And this takes out, as you'll see further on in the Standing Committee Amendment, the term limits of board members. It was the discussion in the committee that probably these board members shouldn't necessarily be term limited. You get down into on the page 4, you'll see before business, they insert outfitting, so it says outfitting business, page 4, line 1 and 2, to further clarify what we're talking about here. Page 5, line 8, after packing services, they insert for the purpose of taking any big or trophy game animals. This is just to further clarify what exactly packing services are. Then you'll see on page 5, line 19 through 20, and page 6, lines 1 through 8, we delete that. That's the part about doing away with the term limits. That's a standing committee amendment. I'd ask for a positive vote.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt the standing committee of the whole standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 88, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. We're back on the bill.
Stand for questions on House Bill 88.
I believe that there's a committee of the whole amendment.
Well, I'm having a problem with amendments. I've done that a couple of times, so I call for the question.
I didn't hear what you said. Would the reading clerk read the amendment?
House Bill 88, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Corrected Copy, page 1, line 9.
Senator Hicks.
Be moved and would like to discuss the amendment. I would concur. This is a very fragile industry at this point in time, and this is a much needed bill to provide some protections from illegal outfitters. But in reviewing the bill, I also thought there was some stuff that we needed to find that we needed to include in the definitions. It brings in Section A of Statute 23-2401, and there's two provisions under that that says exemptions from guides license requirement. And one of them is if you're guiding on your own private property and you're doing it for hire and it's entirely your private property, that's exempted out of there. And that's Section B, Section A. The second section that there's an exemption for having to be a licensed guide or an outfitter is if you're a resident and you're going to take somebody in a wilderness area or you're going to take somebody big hunting. And that section basically deals with that. But when I was reviewing that, I found out one of my good senators from Matrone County's fencing clause is in there. And basically what I'm just trying to do is just make sure that we clarify this. And if you'll go to the amendment, and you go to line 25 underneath there. The way that reads now, it says, will not directly or indirectly accept any compensation for its services. And the amendment would just say direct financial compensation. And what this tries to get at, I don't think there was ever any intent by the outfitters and guides to fence people out, but there's some inadvertent consequences by leaving the word indirectly in there. And let me explain how that would work. If I had my good friend and the senator from Fremont County had an acquaintance or a family member that lived in a different state, and he went hunting with them. And then they said, well, you know, when I get out to Wyoming, I might want to go antelope hunting with you. And if he took that person antelope hunting, that could be construed as indirect compensation for those services that would consequently result in that individual being an illegal outfitter. And I don't think that was the intent. but it's certainly a loophole out there that would preclude you as a resident from hunting with your friends in different states and then bringing them into the state of Wyoming and hunting. And that's all that's intended to do, is basically to clean up that potential loophole. We certainly don't want to create an environment out there that residents are putting themselves out for hire. These guys have to have bonds, license, insurance. It's a very rigorous business that they have to do to. So we want to protect the industry, but on the same aspect, we also don't want to make criminals out of people unknowingly just because they're hunting with their friends in different state or relatives and then having some type of reciprocal thing bringing those in. So that's what that portion of the amendment does under Section 23.2401. And then just kind of following like the good senator from the land of ivory towers, it didn't seem that we wanted to throw a person in jail for up to a year just by taking somebody hunting without a license. So what I did is I asked for the one-year prison sentence to be struck from that. But I have increased the fines, and I'd like to tell you why. Because right now those fines are based on what those equivalent type of services would have drove back when they first wrote this. Right now, if you're going to take somebody elk hunting on public land as an outfitter, you're probably going to be running somewhere between $4,000 and $7,000 for an elk hunt. A high-quality mule deer hunt may range from $3,000 to $6,000. So what it's trying to do is set the fines up at a level that if you get caught doing this, you're not going to make money doing it. If you're selling an illegal outfitter and you're selling an elk hunt for $6,000 and you're only being fined $2,000, there's not much of a deterrent there to do that. So let's try to bring those fines up to what commensurate level of financial remuneration that some illegal outfitter may be taking. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I just a question for the bringer of this amendment. I guess the question is if I owned a cruise ship line and you said, come on out to play at my place to go hunt and I can take you up to some great places to elk hunt. And by the way, I want to invite you to come on a Caribbean cruise with me on one of my cruise lines. Would that be a direct financial compensation or would that be indirect financial compensation?
Chairman, I'd like to divide this amendment, if I could, please. Lines 5 and 6 and lines 37 to 43 would be Division 1. And then the rest in the middle would be Division 2. Division 1 would be lines 5 and 6, and lines 37 through 42, I guess.
I believe that would be divisible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Speaking on division number 1, I've got no problem with that. If the sponsor of the amendment wants to raise the fines from 2 to 5,000, I don't know when the last time they were put at 2,000, so it may be a function of inflation. And I've got no problem with division 1.
Any Senator Meyer?
Land or anything, and I'm going to charge somebody to hunt on my place, either guided by me or somebody directly employed by me, and I'm not an outfitter, am I in violation of this act? And if I am, I just wonder where my private property rights stop and the outfitter's rights begin.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, we're on Division 1 of the Committee of the Whole Amendment, and that's only dealing with raising the penalties for illegally outfitting from 2,000 to 5,000.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, and if I'm violating this act, I want to know whether I'm guilty of a $2,000 fine or a $5,000 fine.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, under subsection A of that, landowners are exempted from requiring to have a licensed guide or outfitter. So as long as you stay entirely on your private property, you can charge for that, and you're not in violation of the statute. So private lands are exempted out.
Senator Meyer.
The second part of my question, if I have my foreman take the guy out to shoot a deer, am I in violation of it? He's under my employ.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is he would not.
Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, on 4, Division 1 of the amendment, I think it's admirable to take out the prison term of 1 year for this, and raising the fines is reasonable. Let's support Division 1 and move on to Division 2.
Question being called. All those in favor of Division 1 say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Division 1 is passed. Division 2. Senator Burns. Question being called on Division 2. All those in favor of Division 2 say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Division 2 is passed. Division being called. All those in favor, please stand. Please stand still. All those opposed, please stand. As I said, Division 2 passed. Further discussion on the amendment? Further discussion on the bill. Hearing none, all those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt the, I'm sorry, all those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 88, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 88 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 99.
House Bill 99, Substance Abuse Treatment Funding Awards, an act relating to the treatment of substance abuse, sponsored by Representative Gingery. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. The report's back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Senators Dockstader, Martin, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole rise to report to do so with the recommendation that House Bill 99 do pass.
Mr. Chairman, there was a standing committee amendment, but I think we can understand the standing committee amendment better if we have an explanation of the House bill first, and then come back and read in and move the standing committee amendment. So at this point, Mr. Chairman, I yield to Senator Von Flatern for an explanation of the House bill.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman. House Bill 99, Substance Abuse Treatment Funding Awards, is codifying the main goal of this bill is to codify what's already being practiced in the Department of Health, in which they look at grants that are applied. They put out the criteria for them. They winnow out all the grants and figure out who's eligible for grants for mental health and substance abuse. This was originally started in 2005 with a $2 million appropriation of general funds to increase the access for treatment for substance abuse. At that time, you all remember the meth initiative was very big in our minds, and we were putting a lot of money into it. Since then, that has been superseded in most cases by just general substance abuse. So the grants now are encompassing everything. We've increased that through 2006 with $4.6 million, and today we are granting about $3 million in a biennium for substance abuse to organizations, public or private entities, as you'll see at the bottom of page one, that can apply for the grants for this kind of sorry, I lost my train of thought here for a moment. It's good question. Thank you. So what the bill does,
let's put in a quiet zone.
Public or private entities that provide this kind of treatment for substance abuse apply to the Department of Health. The Department of Health, through this set of criteria, decides whether or not they're eligible for the grants, and then they dole out the amounts. The way it works is today is that they actually give their recommendations to the Governor's Substance Abuse and Violent Crimes Advisory Council. And so what the second thing this bill does, besides codifying these rules and regulations, it also has the Department of Health making those final decisions. The main sponsor of this bill, when he asked for a little bit of research done on what advisory committees within the governor's office actually dispense funds, well, it turns out none of them do. It comes from an appropriation by us, usually to a department who then dispenses the funds to the grantees. So in this bill itself, you'll notice that the bottom page one talks about public and private entities are allowed to apply. And then on top of page two, the big change is line two, which is reviewed and awarded by the Department of Health. That's a change from how they do now because the Governor's Advisory Committee actually does that. And then if you go on to page two, lines eight and onward through 24 talk about the criteria, which is geographic distribution of treatment resources, and talks about projection, the number of persons who will be treated. Line 20 talks about the monies and that you can do other forms, which is contributions, and that there's a match, that there's at least a dollar of match locally for every $3 of state money provided. And then it goes on the top of three where the Department of Health shall prepare requests for proposal and solicit proposals. Line 8 talks about soliciting of proposals to provide treatment as set forth in this subsection. And then it goes on to call the proposers include an amount of money or other forms of contribution. That's how we verify the local matches. And then, of course, you have to talk about the viability of the program. We're not going to give money to they're going to look at their history, who they provide for, and their economic viability, financial viability. And then anything else they may deem as necessary to find a successful grantee. And onward to the page three, page four, and how it deals with in their budget, the Department of Health, and the funding for this is fiscal year commencing July 2011. This is all existing in our non-codified session law, going clear back to 2005. What this does is codify it. There is an amendment to change part of this bill, and with that explanation of the bill, I stand for questions and possibly a standing committee at this point.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions. I'm wondering how much it's been utilized, and we talk about the funds and how much over since 2005, how much we think we've done with it. And the other question is, in the rules, do we talk about monies or other forms? Do we get into any? Is that like in kind? Is there any kind of direction that's given, or is it just intended to be left wide open?
Senator Von Flattern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far as the in-kind, that is part of it. They can use in-kind as well as cash donations. We have granted out all the money that we've dispensed over the years, which are presently last 4 years. Last two bienniums have been a little over $3 million. In '06, we did $2 million. In House Bill 91 in 06, it was a total of $4.6 million were given, and all were granted out. And that's all around the state.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I ask the Standing Committee Amendment be read in at this time.
House Bill 99, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 2.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, what the Standing Committee Amendment does is the current system is the grants are awarded by the Substance Abuse and Violent Crimes Advisory Board. It's one of many functions that board has. And the testimony in committee was that, by and large, what goes on is the Health Department makes recommendations as to which grantees are appropriate. And the advisory board, by and large, follows those recommendations. But there was one occasion in a recent year where they departed from the recommendations and did not award a grant to a particular grantee that had been recommended. And I think, as I understood the reasoning, it was they felt that grantee did not had some problems and basically was not yet ready for a grant, and that we would have better services if we did not award the money there, but went to other organizations that had their act together a little better. I think that's been about the only occasion where they departed from the Health Department's recommendations. Mr. Chairman, it was discussed in committee, and there was a notable lack of rancor among the various contending parties. The Health Department was perfectly content with the Advisory Board, and the Advisory Board was perfectly content with the Health Department. And nobody was particularly upset about this, but the committee felt that having that extra judgment from this Advisory Board for just the circumstances that arose was valuable. So that's why you see the Standing Committee Amendment before you. Frankly, I don't hold much with the argument that, gee, we always do it the other way. Elsewhere, I think what counts is what works here. And either system's going to work, Mr. Chairman, going to work about the same way. But the committee felt that having the extra judgment from the advisory board was well worth it. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the Standing Committee Amendment. Be happy to answer any questions on it.
Senator Von Flattern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Standing in opposition to this and to save us another amendment later, I would say that there was two reasons. There's two reasons that they took it to the Health Department versus the advisory board making the final decisions in dispensing funds. One reason was that there is no governor's advisory board at dispensing funds, so yes, it is the way we always did it before. The other one was they thought the political influence that could be political pressure that could be put upon an advisory board may take it out of the objective choices and recommendations that should be coming from the Health Department. Now, we all know an agency has some political pressure, can be exerted, possibly. Never heard of it, but there could be that chance. But in this case, when you have an advisory board which is not elected and is appointed by the governor only, and not confirmed by us, by the way, that group itself has more political pressure. And, yes, there was a decision reversed on where the money was going per the recommendations of the health department in the last year. It had nothing to do with my part of the state. But, yes, that did happen. The good tall senator from Natrona County is quite correct about that. But I ask for you to defeat of this because it does belong within the Department of Health, who does do the analysis and picks the successful grantees.
Further discussion on the amendment? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 99, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Division being called, all those in favor, please rise.
Yeah.
All those opposed. Motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 99 has failed. We're back on the bill. I believe that we have a committee of the whole amendment. The committee of the whole amendment having been withdrawn, back on the bill. Question being called, all those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 99, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 99 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 217.
House Bill 217, Production States Agreement, and Act Relating to the Legislature, sponsored by Representative Lubnow. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Coe, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothfuss. Senator Bebout, Chairman. It was reassigned to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senator Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas Peterson, Von Fladeren, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with a recommendation that House Bill 217, Production States Agreement, do pass. Mr. Chairman, there's a standing committee amendment. I ask it to be read in at this time.
House Bill 217, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 3, line 10.
Mr. Chairman.
Sure, be bound.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to explain the bill to the body. The Production States Agreement is sort of a continuation of, many of you may recall, last year the Western Energy Symposium that was conducted in Jackson to get the energy producing and other states in our western part of our country to gather and talk about energy and come up with some kind of a unified position to move forward with things that are important to all of us. And what this does, Mr. Chairman, and the testimony we heard in the Minerals Committee is that initially, one of those states was considering being the lead agency or lead state and gathering groups together to do this. For whatever reason, they've decided to back out. And the majority floor of the House has stepped up and asked the state of Wyoming to do this. And he has had discussions with other states involved in this, including Utah, Alaska, Texas, North Dakota, New Mexico. And the purpose of the bill, Mr. Chairman, is to put together two members from the Wyoming House and two from the Senate we will conduct a meeting, and we will work with members of the other energy producing states to develop an energy producer states agreement. And we've had a lot of discussion during this session about the intrusion and the overreaching acts of the federal government relative to the EPA, the Department of Interior on the BLM Rule 3310. And if you look at the language, Mr. Chairman, you can see that that's exactly what we're talking about on page 2. We encourage domestic development of energy in the U.S. We want to deliver a strong, united voice to the federal government from the states that produce the energy that powers our economy, that we are concerned about existing and proposed federal legislation and federal regulatory processes. Mr. Chairman, it goes on to say that we will gather and have at least, I think, 2 meetings a year to discuss how we put this Energy Producer States Agreement together. And at that point in time, we'll have a unified position and present it to the federal government and those that are creating the problems that we're having to deal with. Mr. Chairman, with that, I would answer any questions.
Senator Nicholas, would you like to have the Standing Committee Amendment read in and then move it?
JAC looked at, or not, the Senate Appropriations Committee looked at the appropriation. There was no budget put together, so it looked like the appropriation, probably half of it would have been appropriated. We know that the former speaker is very skilled and expected a half, so we gave a half plus 500 less and asked that you support the amendment.
Well,
Senator Bebout.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it wasn't quite like that. I will tell you, Mr. Chairman, that I'm comfortable with this amendment.
Further discussion on the amendment? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 217, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 8 has passed. Back on the bill. Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 217, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 217 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 246.
House Bill 246, National Guard Disposal of Land, and Act Relating to the Military Department and the Board of Land Commissioners, sponsored by Representative Kohlberg. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Cooper, Johnson, Landon, Nutting, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 246, National Guard Disposal of Land. And to walk through this wonderful bill, I yield to the senior senator from Hot Springs County, Senator Geis.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, we've got about 3 or 4 armories around the state that sat on state lands or city lands, but not the National Guard. They do not own them. One of them is in Thermop, there's one in Rollins, and I don't know where the other place is. And what this bill does, we'll just hurry up and get to the meat of it. Over on page 2, line 17, in this section of Title 36, identifying this paragraph, and Wyoming Statute 921016B, numeral 3, also shall not apply when any such sale, exchange, or other transfer is to another governmental entity, state agency, or local government, as defined in Wyoming Statute 9103, even if the title to the land and to the buildings thereon are not solely in the name of the Department of Division, therefore, and what it is the town of Samop would like to take over that armory and take it off the hands of the National Guard, and that be their rec center in Thermopolis. I can't answer what's going to happen to the one in Rollins, but that's what it's all about. That armory sets on state land there, same as the schools, the rodeo grounds. I mean, they're all built on state lands, plus the Hot Springs State Park. So that's what this bill does, is allow the National Guard to give this building or sell it to them. I don't know how they're going to negotiate to the town of Thermopolis.
Senator Schiffer.
The amendment, and it's a wee bit of an amendment. It goes in on page 2, line 9.
We have him read the amendment in.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
House Bill 246, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, to engross copy, page 2, line 19.
Senator Schiffer.
I'd move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 246. Mr. Chairman, what it does, it goes in on line 19, and where it reads, where it cites the statute, and it reads subparagraph 3 little I, it changes it to VIII, which changes a little bit. The one deals with commodity classification, and the one we're looking for is how we account for the funds. It's a technical correction. It was just misdrafted, and I ask for your support of the Standing Committee Amendment.
Question. Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 246, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 246 has passed. We're back on the bill. Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 246, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 246 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion is passed.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 7, do pass. House Bill 8, do pass amended. House Bill 20, do pass amended. House Bill 50, do pass amended. House Bill 80, do pass. House Bill 81, do pass amended. House Bill 88, do pass amended. House Bill 99, do pass. House Bill 217, do pass amended. House Bill 246, do pass amended. Senator Martin, Chairman.
Senator Martin.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. That motion is carried and the report has been adopted. We do have some reports from standing committees at this time.
February the 17th, 2011, Mr. President, your Committee Number 12, Rules and Procedures, to whom was referred House Bill 87, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, Hastert, Martin, Nicholas, and Ross, Senator Anderson, Chairman. February the 17th, 2011, Mr. President, your Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 179, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. No, Senator Case. Senator Case, Chairman. February the 17th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 137, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Johnson, Martin, and Scott. No, Senators Case and Hines. Senator Case, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, I believe that clears the desk.
Mr. President, before I make the appropriate motion, just a heads up, we're going into a 3-day weekend. My intent is to come in tomorrow morning a little bit earlier, and we may cut lunch a little bit shorter in hopes of getting you out. It's 3-day weekend. As you can tell, we've done some really, really good work this week, particularly on the budget. Applaud the members of the JAC, and I think tensions have been getting a little bit high. We're a little stressed out, and so it might just be me. but in any event, I move, Mr. President, that the Senate stand adjourned until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning, February 18th.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning in the normal committee room at 7:30 a.m. Committee members, notice the time. House Bill 251, engrossed, Department of Health Reorganization, will finish that one up. House Bill 232, Workers' Comp Impairment Ratings. House Bill 73, Dental Services Freedom Bill. And House Bill 35, Healthcare Choice and Protection Act.
Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resources. We're going to take up a couple little easy bills here. House Bill 163, Water Produced from Geologic Sequence, and House Bill 251, Abortion Ultrasound Information.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, your conference committee for House Bill 124, National Guard Emergency Deployment Professional Licensing, is going to meet tomorrow, February 18th at noon. We were going to meet over in one of the House rooms before we even got there. They threw us out. So now we're going to meet up here in S-14.
Senator Case.
Mr. President, your conference committee on Senate File 23, Mail Ballot Elections, it's going to try to get most of the people together at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning over in Corporations Room in the House side. And so we've been trying to fit this one in, Mr. President. We're working at it.
Keep working. Senator Meyer.
Mr. President, may I have privilege of the floor?
You certainly may.
Mr. President, on my behalf and on behalf of my fellow Appropriations Committee members, we didn't pay a proper tribute to the fine chairman of Appropriations and the hard work that he did on this budget. And, folks, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to have everybody stand up and give this gentleman, this fine senator from Albany, a hand. Yeah. The gestures were with both hands. Mr. President, the House Appropriations, or the Senate Appropriations Committee is going to meet upon adjournment to consider House Bill 23, engrossed, sex offender registration amendments, and will also take up House Bill 235, natural gas vehicles, that just came out of committee today. It was assigned to us.
Other announcements? Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning at 7:30 to take up the following bills. Finalize, and please note the time difference. We're starting a half hour early because we're going to gavel in a half hour early. House Bill 256, Safe Homes Act 2. House Bill 249, Acceptance of Citation. House Bill 190, Electronic Fine Submittal, House Bill 203, Child Support Orders, House Bill 222, No Duty to Retreat. Additionally, Mr. Chairman, we've got on adjournment today, our adjournment of the House and the Senate, your conference committee for Message 59 on Senate File 15, Court Jurisdiction, will meet to see if we can resolve that issue. Thank you, Mr. And that's Senator Christensen, Senator Escobel. Don't forget. Thank you.
Senator Hines.
Mr. President, the Joint Revenue Committee will meet at 8 a.m. tomorrow in room H11 to discuss interim topics. And then at 9 a.m., the Joint Conference Committee on Senate File 128, Abandoned Vehicles, will meet in S16 at 9 a.m.
Other announcements? You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. We will stand adjourned until 9:30. 9:30 tomorrow morning, February 18th. We are adjourned.